Clock, so let's get started. Any introductions or announcements?
Do have some, couple of thoughts. One, I spoke to Commissioner Bowman today, and I informed him that when I took attendance over the years, that I noticed that proxies were often the reason that there was a quorum. The commissioner, of course, is the one responsible for appointing membership to FMAC. His response to me was no proxies. So that means he would like to see the members be here. Tonight we don't have Skip Feller. You know, he's not going to be here. And we have one more. I'm looking at Alexa. Skip Feller and Ernest Bowden. Okay, Ernest Bowden. So two are missing right there. The other thing is we now have 11 members. Because Jack Austin did retire from FMAC, and he sent some early information about that. So we're down to 11 members. I'll let the commissioner know about that, about adding any new members. You do have a quorum, but a lot of times in the past, there really wasn't a quorum unless proxies saved the day, but that's really not what the intention of FMAC is. So I wanted to let you know that. Also wanted to let you know that you can probably count on more meetings than typically FMAC has had over the last 4 years or so. There's a lot of things you're going to hear tonight. You'll understand why I say that. There's a lot of activity coming out of the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, and we'll go through all that, but, you know, pretty good chance that we're back to where things were maybe 10 years ago when FMAC met probably a half a dozen times a year. And I think the last time we did that was a striped bass issue where we had three meetings of FMAC and the fourth one had the ASMFC here giving the, you know, the public hearing. So, but that's the last time I remember there being numerous FMAC meetings. So thank you very much.
All right. Next issue is the approval of the meeting minutes from the last meeting. Everybody get a chance to review them? Any changes? Motion to approve?
So moved.
Second? All right, minutes are approved. Okay, we'll start with the presentation by staff on the February recreational black sea bass.
Good evening, committee members. My name is Alex Aspinwall, and I'm the technical committee representative for Virginia for black sea bass. And today we will be discussing recreational wave one black sea bass fishery for February 2019. So to recap, NOAA opened up federal waters in February of 2018. Both Virginia and North Carolina participated in the February black sea bass fishery. And in doing so, we're required to report on catch estimates and also to monitor biological data. So similar situation this year in February, federal waters are open. However, the board has made it very clear that any states that wish to participate in this fishery will be required to make season adjustments according to what they harvest in February of that year. So for example, if Virginia wants to participate in a February fishery this year, whatever we harvest in February, we will be responsible for making season adjustments to account for that additional harvest in February. That's not necessarily part of our season yet. So to look at last year in February, we harvested about 6,459 pounds of black sea bass. We had just over 400 black sea bass permits issued, and there were 64 reported trips. If there are any overages, it's been discussed that overages would not be paid back until 2020. So the table in front of you, let me use a mouse here. The table in front of you is really to show you how many days that we would have to forfeit by wave. So you see wave three, wave four, wave five, and six. So how many days we would have to forfeit in each wave to achieve what we harvested last year. So we don't know what we're going to harvest in February this year, but what we do know is what we harvested last year. So if we were to make season adjustments to wave three, we would have to account for, we'd have to forfeit approximately 14 days. If we wanted to take that from wave four, that would be 29 days, 23 days in wave five. Wave six historically does not have very high average landings, and therefore we'd have to forfeit more days in wave six.
Sure.
Is it our quota combined with Maryland and Delaware?
Yeah, we are in a regional.
As a consortium of states or group of states, where was that? How did that turn out from a quota perspective? In other words, did we catch 100% of the quota, 80%, 90%?
You might have it right in front of you. I think it's actually probably the last table or two in that packet, which shows a recreational black sea bass landing.
So regionally, then we were at 100.
It should say black sea bass.
It does. So,
okay.
But if we were at 100%.
Well, I mean, I don't think we. I think we were under it. I think we were slightly under it. I recall, but anyway. So the February season is outside the RHL. So the season size and bag limit is all by states to achieve the RHL. This February season is outside of that. So whatever we harvest in February, we have to account for in some way.
I understand that, but what I was trying to get to is what were the actuals in 2000? I mean, we're going to make some recommendation for 2019.
Sure.
I wanted to see where we were in 2018 so that I could make an educated guess. If I read this right, regionally, well, I don't know if I'm reading it right now. Regionally, it says 5.89%.
I'm going to add something here, Alex, we get to it. But last year in the region that went from Delaware to North Carolina, we were given an allocation of 301,000 pounds, I think it was.
301,000?
Yeah. And because of that, when the February fishery was reviewed, there was enough of a surplus in that allocation that NOAA said, you don't have to pay anything back for February. This year is a different situation. This year there's no allocation. Everything was done by spec setting, and so we don't have the ability to fold what we do into February into an allocation because there is no allocation. And I'll get to that later on, what happened when the ASMFC went through their addendum recently. Right. So consequently, the amount of poundage Alex has there is what we start off with. So when we send our proposal to ASMFC, we have to automatically account for that 6,000 plus fish.
Right.
And then we hope we don't have anything over. But if it's better year this year than 2018 was, well, then the 2020 comes into play.
So my question has no merit at all. There's no bearing.
That's okay.
Like apples and kumquats.
Jeff.
Yeah. Tom.
Thank you.
I have a more difficult question, I think. So on every other fishery we've seen numbers on, MRIP shows a higher recreational catch than historic when they back calculated the historic numbers. Is this fishery the same way? And if so, are we harvesting to old numbers or new numbers, which should be, I would think, substantially more?
Yeah.
And if they're using new statistics and the basis is on old numbers, then there's a big disconnect there, and we're going to get messed up, to be polite.
Yeah, absolutely. So these numbers are using the old MRIP estimates. So I did it both ways. I used the new MRIP and the old MRIP estimates. And I was told because allocations were based on the old methodology that we would be using the old MRIP until the stock assessment was available. So this is the old.
So we're counting apples and apples now
right now,
through the rest of the year when we have to compensate for the 6,000 fish or whatever it ends up being.
Yes.
time out. It says you have it in bold letters, new MREP.
That's not looking at what we harvested last year. That's just the new MREP estimates by state and by region. If you want it, if you want the old uncalibrated estimates, I can
go ahead and continue.
Okay. So so my question is, so does FMAC want to recommend, knowing that we would have to make a season adjustment, to recommend that we make have a 2019 sea bass fishery? And if so, would you like it to be adjusted for the fewest days given up in the season, which would likely be wave three? Do we want to make season adjustments similar to how we had it in 2017, where we had a gap from September 22nd to October 21st? Or do we want to take the season from, do you want to take, make season adjustments from the end of the season? And so, and we'll be taking your recommendation because we have a public hearing on this matter at the end of the month. And that's all I have, so I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay. Yeah.
Is it 6,000 pounds of fish? Where'd that number come from?
That came from permitting reports and call-ins.
Those are our numbers, or those?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. Thank you. That's good. I'm glad. Yes. And so they're accepting our numbers. All right. That's a step in the nice direction. I got two questions. That was the one I kind of going. Oh, I guess, and he is correct. We are going to be talking about this in what, a week, 2 weeks, something like that. And so, you know, we do need to have some kind of opinion on whether we should have the February season, and if we do have the February season, well, that was the other. You know, what would be the least bad compensation? Was anything other than closed days looked at, like adjusting bag limits?
No, I did not look at adjusting bag limits. I just looked at adjusting.
That's it. I'm done with questions.
I have enough. Okay, John.
You mentioned a potential gap during the month of September. I'm assuming. No, I don't want to assume anything. How did you arrive at the days?
The days? Okay. The days is, so in the table, what I do is I take the average landings from the past 2 years. So the average landings in wave three is about 22,835 pounds. What you do is you divide that by how many days are within that wave. And so what you get, what you have is essentially a daily landings rate.
All right.
So you treat every day equally.
In order to come up with the dates in the gap that you were, how did you pick the days that were going to be the gap?
That's what the season was in 2017. Existing season. So something that's already been put in place in the past, and if that was something that was
right,
was accepted, then maybe that's an avenue we can pursue.
So that would be a little more closure than we would need when you're looking at that September 21 to October. Put that back up, please.
So that's what I was trying to get to.
We need 23 days in that wave. That would be more than 23 days.
Yeah, no. Yeah, the idea was just to see if that gap, give or take, you know, 1 or 2, 3 days, is that something that would be of interest, or do you want it from the beginning, or do you want it from the end? So.
One more?
Yes, sir.
What's your personal opinion on what we should do?
I think we should take it probably from wave three. I think we should, you know, the fewest days in the beginning of the season and have a continuous season.
So, the question about taking it from wave three, and I'm not a cold water fisherman kind of guy, so I'm going to look at Ken. What else do we have? What other fisheries are out there for the people that are the guys that go fishing every weekend?
It's talk. I mean, that's what we're down to. The coastal striped bass fishery has disappeared. Blue line tilefish has been closed. It's now a summer fishery. So you're really looking at tog and sea bass is what you have. There is a very limited number of guys that are still deep dropping for swords.
But on the other hand, if we close in September, days in September, there's lots of inshore species and things that people can be fishing for. Flounder's still around.
Everything's around.
And so there's more. The concern is that you don't want to close it so that people don't have anything to fish on or we're down to one species and that's kind of sort of it, if we can keep multiple species open, especially when there are multiple species that you can happen to catch in the same trips, targeting and fishing the same way. So that would be my only issue, and why I would ask you to consider the September type closure, especially if that's what we normally have, what we have now. I just don't know. We've had it in the past, and there didn't seem to be much complaint about it then.
And any other opinions from the committee?
I agree with Tom. I think the as long as there's something else for people to catch, I think that would be the best time to shut it down.
Okay. How about from the audience? Any black sea bass fishermen have an opinion of the spring or the winter fishery? Please. Please come up and give them your name and...
Captain Will Bransom. I'm a recreational angler. Some of the observations I have about the winter fishery is, and those are 64 reports, two of those were mine, and I didn't average anywhere near 100 pounds per report on mine, because that's what that 6,400 pounds and 64 reports kind of comes out to. I didn't have anywhere near that on my harvest. I'm in favor of a February fishery open for sea bass, even if it means we have to pay back later, whether it's a closure of some amount of days or, as Ken has alluded to, a restriction in possession limit from 15 to something other, that I think before the commission meets should be investigated to say, here's a couple different options. If we cut it to 10 per fish in February of this year, because for me, deep drop for golden tile that's open now, and barrel fish and grouper and togs, you're going to catch sea bass when you're tog fishing. And the idea of releasing them in 100, 150, 160 feet of water, not so much a problem on my boat. I use a barrel release mechanism, and I've got tagging data that shows that my fish have been returned healthy and all this, but from the deeper wrecks. But it's a bycatch of tog fishing in the wintertime are sea bass. And so, you know, if you allow some measure of harvest in February, even if it's not the full 15, that's helpful to the fishermen who go out there to the Triangle or to any of the other deeper wrecks, that they can take some sea bass home when they catch legal sea bass when they're catching togs. The other issue I have with opening a February fishery is that we have 1 year in the last, how many, you guys can answer, how many wave one data points do you have with NOAA or anybody else on black sea bass fishery? The answer is none in like 10 years. So we don't have wave one fishery harvest data for black sea bass. Nobody does, because nobody's had the season open. So having an open season gives you some of that data. Now, we only got one data point, and that's last year, 6,400 pounds and 64 trips. But you kind of need that as fishery managers, is that if you're going to in the future open a harvest in wave one, you're going to need some data points to base some decision on. And that's why I think it's beneficial to have a season in February to some extent. And you can look at other different measures in later in the year in September, whether you close it like we once had a couple years ago and prior, or you limit it, you close it during so many days during a weekday when you don't have a lot of recreational anglers out there. There's all kinds of creative measures that you can probably come up with to mitigate the impact of fishing. I'd like the idea of closing it later in the year if we have to make up for this year's catch that we didn't have to last year. That will that I support. But let me say something about last year's fishery. I only got out twice because the weather sucks in wave one. And so 64 trips, okay, I could believe that in Hampton Roads. But the weather is not so good for fishing this time of year. So it takes a hearty soul to get out there. And so I think capturing wave one fishing data for black sea bass harvest data, I think, is very important. I think we should do it. What degree? Maybe a little bit less than 15 per person per day or something. But I think it's important for the fishery managers to capture that data for future decision making. And it gives the anglers like myself an opportunity to keep sea bass when you wrangle a 10-to-1 catch ratio with togs out on the deeper wrecks. It lets me a chance to keep the ones we can. So that's all I got. Any questions for me?
Good input.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Something to add, which is, since you have four headboat trips. So that, that's what.
Who were those headboats? Skip, I was going to ask. Skip, come on up, please.
So we hope that there's going to be more headboats.
I'm Mike Avery, and I just wanted to express the support for the opening of a February fishery. I do agree that it does allow the anglers to have more choices during February, where there's just not much to fish for, and so that gives those choices there to them. I do object to the whole payback notion at all when you compare the Delmarva harvest compared to the northern state harvest. We're still peanuts, so us paying back what the little we catch, it just seems not such a good plan for us. But if we're being told to do that and we don't have an option, then we'll sit down and color, I guess. All I would ask for is, if we do have to pay it back, is that we pay back in a fair manner, because we don't catch much in February. And so you really can't count a day of catching in February to a day in catching during the normal season, because I don't think there is a comparison. It is much less. So I would like to have some sort of fair payback system where what we pay back is comparable to what we're catching in February. It's not day for day. I don't know what it is, but it can't be day for day. I can't believe it. Pound for pound, okay, if we can figure out how to pay back the pounds. But one day of fishing in February is not a day out of the regular season, I don't think. And so
I think they're
asking whatever we pay back just be in a fair manner is all.
Yeah, staff has different quotas for different periods, different daily landings, pound for pound. So.
Okay, that's all I ask, is that our payback be fair, and we don't take 28 days out of our regular season.
Appreciate it very much. Yes, sir.
My name is Wes Blow, recreational fisherman. I think it's very important that Virginia does have this season, because Rob has been fighting to get Virginia back a winter fishery season for years. So if we don't do this, the management, organizations that control that will say, well, it's not important to them, so we may not have that opportunity again. So I think it's very important for us to do it. And the other point is that, like Kim was saying, there's pretty much nothing else to fish for, that time of the year. In wave three, there's everything in the world to fish for. So, if you take away black sea bass at that point in time, people aren't hurt. They have plenty of other things to fish for. So I would strongly recommend that Virginia do proceed forward with giving us the February season. I want a January through April season, but Rob hasn't been able to get that for me yet. It's very important for us to have it. Take away from wave three or four, there's plenty of other things to fish for then. I would not want to see it taken off of the end of the year.
Great. Thanks. Thank you. Appreciate it. Yes, blue shirt.
I'm Stan Zimmerman. I'm a recreational fisherman and also president of the Peninsula Saltwater Sport Fishermen's Association. And we discussed this last night at our board meeting, and I personally and the club itself strongly supports a February fishery for sea bass. I could echo all the points that Will Branson made, and those are all valid points, and we agree with all those.
My input. Any preference for when we pay back if we have to?
Wave three, I think.
Wave three?
Yep. Either that or, limiting bag limit, minimizing the bag limit a little bit.
Okay. All right.
We just seem to see, the fish we see in February seem to be much larger fish overall. And certainly do. Instead of taking 15, take, a dozen or 10 or something.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yes, sir.
I'm Denny Dobbins. I'm one of your delegates to the Recreational Advisory Board with the for sea bass, tog, and scub. Give a little history about how all this mess came about. Back, there's no data. There was physically no data on Virginia sea bass. What we were lumped in with the Northeast. We moved and got that somewhat separated. But at that time, the scientists thought that sea bass moved north-south, migrated rather than east-west, which is what they actually do. We probably should be separated totally out, away from even Maryland and Delaware, but we couldn't do that at that time. The idea of having the number of days in February cut out and then having that was my recommendation. I pushed to get February put in to be allowed. Because that's one of the best. I also hold a couple of records on sea bass, but that's one of the best times to catch sea bass. It's limited by the number of days you physically get out to that area. September was chosen because that was what we were allowed to use. That wave was the only one that we could actually. October had been much better because less fishery, but there weren't that many people who participated in October, November, December in the fishery. We came up with the numbers at the least possible intrusion using the required terminology of the act as far as number of days we could have and what the actual fishery, what the stock was at that point. No one has any idea. That's the reason our stock assessment is so poor. We have no real idea, and really have no idea at this time what it is in the South versus Delaware and Maryland. Look at the percentage of landings. Now, that's skewed somewhat by the fact that we have one of the ports that's open for landings that when the other ports are not open. But still, our percentage, Virginia, talking only about Virginia, Virginia's portion is very low, commercially and recreationally. Look at North Carolina. Look at the other states in the Northeast. They have a crisis as far as sea bass. We don't. We really have no crisis as far as sea bass. There is vast amounts. However, the landings and such are, like I say, skewed by the fact of Hampton here having, and Newport News having ports that are open for that time.
Okay.
Will's right, though. The only thing out there to catch, and he does a good job about releasing sea bass, but when you land them catching tog and the various other bottom fish, the tile fish, they're dead.
Yeah.
We need to do something about that, but maybe a different way of accounting for that. But we haven't done that this time.
Do you think it would help to have an effort to educate fishermen on returning the fish to the bottom safely?
No.
No?
No, I don't. It is, and Will will tell you, it's very troublesome.
I'm sure it is.
And how to take and do it. There's about five different techniques. It's been tried. None of them work too well.
All right.
It's pretty much if you bring them up from that depth and dump them, they're going to die.
All right.
So you don't fish for them, or you take and catch them as a bycatch of other fisheries.
How do you feel about a reduction in the bag limit?
Say again?
How do you feel about a reduction in the bag limit?
I don't think that's the problem. Like I said, it's not the number of fish that's available. Virginia has no problems as far as numbers of fish. I wish Lewis was here. He'd point out to you exactly. We did studies. I tagged several thousand sea bass, and they move east-west.
Right. Lewis is behind you, but.
Oh, okay. Well, he,
all right.
He can probably handle it.
All right.
It's well, not a problem. We just don't have a date.
Thank you very much. Anybody else? All right, we go back. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead. Have comments?
No, that's okay. I was just going to say that so far I've heard three different options. One is that we could possibly close some days in wave three, possibly close the September 21st to about October 13th date. And then the third option is to reduce the bag limit. What does the committee feel like is an option that they would like to move forward so we can recommend it to the committee?
I would like to make a motion first just to get this one off.
Oh, that's what we'd like to do.
Okay, I'd like to make a motion that we support the opening of February, independent of what we do about it, but that's a motion. And then we'll have a second motion for when to close or bag limit and things like that.
Well, I think we're pretty unanimous on opening February. I don't know that we need to do a separate motion, but
it's fine.
Okay.
Is it a consensus in that?
Is there anybody here that disagrees? Any objections to opening February again?
Okay, so that's okay. There. So
seeing none, let's say
that's fine. Can you put your table of days up that you had on your early slide? So if we close 14 days in wave three, which there seems to be support on, and that's May, June, so there is plenty of things to fish for then we can, that's a reasonable compromise. Now, are we fishing for tog then? I don't know what the tog season is anymore.
The tog is open now.
No, in May.
Yeah, but the tog season goes to what? It's May's open now.
Talking to the mic, I can't hear what he's saying.
16 May to 30 June, tog is closed this year.
So it would be a reasonable thing. When is it, and when is wave three nominally open?
May 15th.
So
May 15th to June 30th would be the entire wave three.
So if we took off, if we closed this fishery at the same time as tog was closed, then we wouldn't have bycatch as an issue.
You could also have a starting date like June 1st, continuous to the end of the year. That would also be 14, 15 days, something like that.
Yeah.
Less confusion.
So, I mean, that's something to consider. And then I'm going to sit back and let people fish for these things because I have a little boat. I don't get to where I can catch ones you keep.
Any other suggestions? Tom, would you like to make a motion to that? Oh, I'm sorry.
How much would you have to reduce the bag limit for the entire year to cover what would be?
Substantially more. I mean, the reducing the days would have a larger impact on reducing the bag limit, for sure.
Okay. Yeah, normally, the distribution on bag limits is not many people get the entire bag limit, and you've got to count it that way.
Gotcha.
You don't get much credit for it. All right. Would you like to make a motion that we?
Sure, but I don't know exactly what day it would be, what days it would be. And that would be open at nominally, well, right now, does the commission have to set a date now, or do they wait until we get the harvest reports in and then set a date? How are you working it?
I don't know about the harvest reports, but what we can do with the technical committee is have conservationally equivalent proposals.
Right.
So we could have something that closed wave 3 for 14 days, closed in wave 5 for 23 days. We could take a look. I think we should take a look at the bag limit. But I think most of you understand that you don't get much credit for dropping down to 10 fish probably. But maybe there's a few days there. So we could have three proposals going to the ASMSC. And then we could come back, let everyone know how that went, and then the commission is going to be interested in one thing. They're going to be interested in February fishery right now. That's going to be what's January 22nd. So we do have some time to come back to the commission and set the full season. It would be ideal if we didn't have to do that, bringing the same information, same regulation back twice. So think about that as well. If you have uncertainty, then we can do that. But the preference is that we do one fell swoop on January 22nd.
Alex, did you say there's going to be a public hearing?
The commission meeting, there'll be a public on the 22nd.
Okay, so we'll make a recommendation, and then all that will go out to the public hearing.
Right.
Okay. All right.
I think the consensus around the table is that we close the in May for the 13 days, which is a minimal closure on number of days, and it also happens to be when TOG is closed, which helps with the bycatch, and so that would be my motion or recommendation.
Okay, anybody seconded?
Yep.
Okay.
That sounds like that's what we're all saying.
I think it is, yeah. John Bellow. Any objections to the motion? Seeing none, the motion passes. There you go.
Next.
Thank you.
Incidental take permits for gillnets.
Good evening. So for you committee members who have not had the pleasure of meeting before, I'm Sarah. I'm a fisheries management specialist. Here at VMRC, and for the last 6 months, I've been working on our incidental take permit application for protecting 5 species of sea turtles. We are currently in the process of completing 2 applications for incidental take permits required by the federal government under the Endangered Species Act from our gillnet fishery. We must apply for these permits because the commercial gillnet fishery is known to interact with Atlantic sturgeon and also 5 species of sea turtles that are either threatened or endangered. Therefore, we were required to apply for these take permits from NOAA's Office of Protected Resources. And the permits we are writing applications for are for 25 years in length. The permit applications basically are composed of 3 parts: a description of the fishery that the application is for, a request for an allowable estimate of takes, a take being defined as any interaction between a protected species and a commercial gillnet, regardless of whether or not the animal is released dead or alive. And then also a conservation plan that includes monitoring and bycatch reduction measures to be implemented by the state and also enforced by the state. So the sturgeon ITP application was pretty much completed in 2017. It was presented to FMAC in full at that time, and I have not had the opportunity to work on that application since it was done before I arrived. Because we are so pressed for time at this meeting and there are a lot of issues we want to get to, I'm going to give a very short overview of the sturgeon ITP application, and I'll be happy to take any questions on it after the presentation, after the meeting, at any point. Please contact me. But the gist of it is that we requested that we be allowed, or the gillnet fishery be allowed, 1,056 takes of sturgeon per year, 211 of those which were lethal. And over the course of the entirety of the permit application, that's 26,400 takes. NOAA Protected Resources has unofficially accepted this application. They just wanted to wait until we added these 5 species of sea turtles and submitted a separate application for that. And as I said before, I'm happy to go over the conservation details of the sturgeon plan later. But for the last 6 months, I've been working on this Sea Turtles ITP application, and I really want to get your thoughts on how I have constructed it. So the turtle application covers 5 species of endangered and protected sea turtles that the federal government has said they know to interact with gillnet fisheries in our waters. That includes the loggerhead, Kemp's Ridley, green, leatherback, and Hawksbill sea turtles. And these are listed in order of those that occur most commonly to least commonly. To determine the requested number or the estimated number of requested sea turtle takes, we are using a bycatch model that was provided to us by NOAA. The data we're feeding into the model comes from a commercial reporting system, so all the harvest reports that you provide us, the Protected Species Observer Program, and also the Virginia Aquarium Response Program. And the number of takes that we request are not static. We can adapt them, particularly over the first 5 years of the permit, based on new data that we are collecting. So when we ran the model provided us by NOAA, the numbers that we got were actually very low, problematically low. So we decided that in order to prevent a closure of our fishery, we decided that a better take would be to split up Virginia state waters into different management areas and look at those management areas separately. The management areas that I've come up with here are based on a number of factors, including fishing effort and season, the type of species caught, and also turtle habitat. So the first area is this Atlantic Ocean, coastal ocean off of the eastern shore, the coastal ocean off of Virginia Beach, the seaside bays. We have the eastern Chesapeake Bay main stem. And I want to apologize. I was new to the program I used to make this map, and I seem to have obliterated Tangier Island. It was an accident. I'm going to try to get it back. And then the western main stem of the Chesapeake Bay, the lower tributaries of the bay, and then the upper tributaries of the bay. As soon as this presentation is completed, I'm going to ask for your questions and your thoughts, and I'm particularly interested in hearing what you think about the way these management areas were divided. So when we ran the model using these specific management areas, this is a table of the proposed number of takes that we are going to be requesting as the allowable takes for each management area and each species. And as you can see, it varies greatly, both by area and species. So the ocean off Virginia Beach and the seaside bays have pretty low harvests, so they have lower number of allowable takes. Loggerheads are much more, and Kemp's Ridley are much more frequently occur in our waters than, say, Hawksbill leatherback. So we have more allowable takes of them. Well, I should say proposed allowable. These are the takes we are requesting from them. One of the ways, or really the primary way, that we are going to be monitoring takes is by the observer program that's already in place. So BMRC's Protected Species Observer Program. And this is a map. Sorry, the green doesn't come across so well on this projector, but this is a map of the observer coverage for the first 2 years of that program. So that program started in summer of 2016, and this is all the nets that they observed through summer of 2018. And the observer program is specifically targeting to be or to have observed 1% of commercial gillnet trips annually. So because the observer program is has a coverage of 1% of the fishery, we then have to request the number of observed takes based on that 1% estimate. So we basically get 1% of the total allowable takes as our observed takes, what this basically boils down to is that we get one species of turtle per management area per year. However, we are the way we are writing this permit application is that we're requesting that for the first five-year period of the permit, that period be deemed a data collection period. Therefore, we will reestimate the observed takes allowed during that five-year period prior to implementing any punitive measures for the fishery. And I'll go into that a little later. So the bycatch reduction methods that we are including in the application or incorporating into the application, first of all, include all the existing gillnet regulations that have been put in place on the commercial fishery in order to protect dolphins, large whales, harbor porpoises, and sea turtles. Everything that we have already done is going to be counted towards this application. So I just want to emphasize that. The only potential regulations that we are considering, and again, this is another point where I would really looking forward for your feedback. We are considering adding a regulation that requires fishermen to allow observers on their boats if they are asked. The observers would not be asking if they don't have to. They're going to be asking if they need coverage for an area, and you're the only fisherman that goes out in that area. So it's not going to be a now we're calling everyone situation. It really is an as-needed basis. And then the second regulation that we are considering is requiring the reporting of turtles to BMRC by phone or email within 24 hours of the take. And this regulation might be really important during that first 5 years of data collection because we need more data. Our numbers are low because the data is scant. And the reason why we need more data is because the last bycatch reduction measure is if allowable estimated or observed takes that we are requesting, and if they're accepted, if those takes are exceeded in a management area, the fishery in that management area may be closed for the remainder of the year, which is concerning considering the observed takes are one species per management area, or one of each species per management area, which is why we have used an adaptive management approach in our conservation plan. What this allows us to do is request, as I mentioned before, the first 5 years of the permit be a data collection phase. Any overages of takes, be them observed or estimated, would count towards the allowable takes for previous years rather than initiating a closure of the fishery. And that could be up to a five-year period as we have written the application now. So not if we had two in 1 year, we would take it from one of them from the next year. If we had three in 1 year, we could take one of them from the next year and one from the following year. Each time we reach a total take, you know, we would then, rather than, and prior to closing the fishery or in that management area, we would instead, during that five-year period, use that data to re-estimate the requested number of takes in the permit, to go back to NOAA Office and Protected Resources and say, our numbers were bad, we have more data, we need more. And then lastly, during that five-year data collection period, we could also reconfigure how the management areas are applied. So we configure that map basically into different management areas and also potentially introduce different bycatch reduction measures. So instead of going straight to shutting down the fishery, we could make the argument that implementing max soak durations, yardage restrictions, and attendance requirements would be a better step. But because in some of these areas we only have one allowable take, you know, usually those kind of alternatives are applied when you're nearing your maximum. Once you've exceeded maximum, the standard practice is to shut down the fishery. So we need more data. We need as much data as possible. And right now, no turtles have been observed through BMRC's Protected Species Observer Program in the last 2.5 years that it's been implemented. And only one turtle has been observed in Virginia waters by the Federal Northeast Fisheries Observer Program between 2005 and 2016. And anecdotally, I believe that none have been observed in 2017 or 2018 either. I have not heard any, but I also don't have definitive proof of that. So basically the moral of the story is our numbers are low. The first 5 years of this permit, there wouldn't be any really repercussions if we reach those numbers. But we need to collect data during those first 5 years that give us some proof that those numbers are too low, that they're not low for a reason, but they're low and give us ability to kind of buffer, protect this fishery. So that's where the turtle ITP application stands of right now, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, but I would specifically like to hear any concerns or thoughts you have on the project as of right now.
Any questions?
Is it possible we don't have a turtle problem? You're saying the numbers are low. Are the measures that we've put in place with gill nets preventing us from catching them? Are they doing what they're supposed to be doing?
That is possible. However, because the federal government feels that these turtles, which are threatened and endangered, are interacting with, they have proof that they're interacting with gill net fisheries along the Atlantic. And our fishery is along the Atlantic seaboard.
Right.
They're requiring us to have this permit application in place. But they're willing to work with us to make it so they don't want to shut down our fisheries. You know, they're willing to allow us to potentially even, like I said, to re-estimate these numbers as soon as we have more data.
So you want us to target turtles? It comes right back to that.
I don't want you to target turtles, but I want to make sure when we say to, I want to make sure all the turtles, that any turtles you catch that we know about.
Right.
And that's just.
So we're not catching them, but the federal government says, yes, we are.
The federal government says we're worried that you might. And so we need a plan in place that will protect them because that's required by the Endangered Species Act.
The trial period on the first 5 years for the turtles, is that going to work for the sturgeon also?
So the sturgeon application has a trial period that is currently written as 3 years.
Okay, so for the next 3 years, that can be adjusted.
Yeah, so they've given an unofficial go-ahead on that sturgeon application. They say, we like what you wrote, we're good with it. As soon as we get the turtle application in, they're going to review both again and give us the official stamp of approval, and that's when the permit starts applying. And that's when the three-year period, the sturgeon data collection period will begin, and that's when the five-year turtle data collection period will begin.
Can you pad it a little bit? If you think it's low, is it something, knowing if you're only targeting 1%, to multiply that to give us some leeway in there.
So dividing the state waters into management areas is padding it a little bit. You know, if without that division, we would have two loggerheads that the observer program could see in all of Virginia and one of each other species. So by dividing it into management areas, we're making that 7 loggerheads and 7 of each species in all of the Virginia.
In each area.
One in each area. But if it would be 2 loggerheads and 1 of each species if we looked at Virginia waters as a whole.
Okay.
We can't pad it more than that initially because we have a model that they have said you have to work with. Because you have no better data to create a better model with, we don't have any data, we have to use their model, and since there's really no alternative with coming up with one ourselves, and that model doesn't allow for padding. You know, we can't, they can check our numbers, basically, and say, if we were to pad it. But if we start to take turtles in each of these areas, we can say, you know, we're seeing them at a higher frequency. You know, we should, we're seeing two or three, we're catching three turtles in the east part of the Chesapeake Bay main stem. You know, right now we're only allotted one. But if we caught three in 1 year, then obviously one's not enough. We really should add. So that kind of data.
So whatever we catch, that's what they're going to allow us.
Well, I'm not sure that it's going to be an exact one for one. That process is going to have to be refined during the data collection period. But yeah, the more we catch during that data collection period, it's not going to be held against us. It's just going to allow us to have larger numbers when we move past that data collection period into a monitoring period.
Right.
In which case, those numbers are set, and the bycatch measures that we implement in that part will kind of be more set. Although there's leeway to negotiate this more with NOAA Office of Protected Services. Like, it's theoretically possible that we say we need to reevaluate this every 5 years for the 25-year period.
Right.
Okay. John?
Just confirm, there's no downside if we don't have any. True
yeah.
or false?
Oh, true. Right. If no turtles are caught, like, so if this is currently under operation, no turtles have been reported to us, and the observer program has not caught any turtles. So if this started back when the observer program started, for the 2.5 years it's running, there's been no issues. Nothing will happen.
Can you put your first chart back up there with take?
Yes, sir.
Well, you had one that had takes, and then I thought there was is there one before that?
So there's one after it that has just one in each?
No, prior to that.
Oh, for sturgeon, this?
It does. My question no longer applies. Move on. Sorry.
Okay.
Hey, Tom.
So first is back to the fundamental question I think John was trying to ask. So let's just say you get none. And then 1 year, we catch three.
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean the entire bay, or, you know, that area gets closed? Because before then we had none, so we don't get any credit for having historically done it, and then we're closed?
So that is what we are trying to guard against with that first 5 years.
Okay.
After that first 5 years, the way the application is being written currently, and we can change it because it's not like we've submitted it yet. Anything you want, I can add into this application. But the way it's currently being written is we're looking at that 5-year advisory period. However, in previous talks that I haven't been privy to, that I've seen emails of from before I got here, there was some talk about, instead of just a single data collection period, reevaluating the data collection across the 25.
Which is not a terribly unreasonable thing if one thinks that the turtles are recovering and there'll be more of them out there, and so there'll be more interactions.
Absolutely.
Which is fine. The second question I have is, if you're going to rely on a phone-in system for reporting, how are you going to ensure that people do not game the system and just lie?
And, like, report a whole bunch.
Yeah, or report, you know, get amongst their buddies. I mean, these men and women out there are not dumb. They can see this stuff coming. They've been through this before. And if you tell them that the rules are going to be, if we get 50 interactions or 10 interactions this year, then we'll be able to get 10 interactions for the next 25 years per year without any problem, you can bet that people will get together and say, we're going to call in. You get this week, and you get 3 weeks from now, and you get another one in 4 weeks until they get
observers.
That's a great point. I would say there would be a backlash to that. If we start reporting that we are observing too many turtles, the federal government is then going to be like, well, it looks like you have a much bigger problem, so these may be kind of loosey-goosey conservation plans that you put in place. It's no longer going to hold anymore. We need something stricter happening.
I think the interactions are probably more than you think, based on your observer program, which is none.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's a serious issue because of all the measures we've already got put in place.
Right.
But I am concerned that if you're relying on unsubstantiated reporting, that things can get messed up one way or the other. I don't know which way, but
we're not relying on unsubstantiated reporting. Right now, we are relying on the observer program.
That's right, but.
But yeah, I hear you. I think that's a very legitimate concern.
I can address your concern. There's not a fisherman that's going to call in and say he's caught a turtle or a sturgeon. They're afraid. I know that I still have guys every now and then that say we caught 3 sturgeon a day, but we didn't say anything to anybody because they're afraid if they report
caught
these numbers.
They caught and turned them back loose.
Correct. It's
still a take.
It's still a take. It doesn't matter if it's dead or alive. It's still considered a take. But they're afraid to report them because they feel like they're going to get shut down. So I don't think you got to worry about this group getting together and calling in 10 and this group getting together. It's not going to happen. It's hard enough. These guys are telling me, yes, we need to sturgeon, and I'm telling them, you guys need to report that, and they're still not doing it because they're still afraid to. So I don't think that's a legitimate concern, I don't think.
Now, if the observer data suddenly caught 3, it'd probably be the following year. That's how usually they'll do it. They'll give you a number based on what you've had in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And since we haven't caught any in the past, that's why I don't know this is.
I take it we don't have any experience to tell us which species of turtles prefers which part of the bay or the East Coast. I mean, is it really possible to find all of the different species in uprivers?
Yeah. So all of these turtles have actually been found all over state
really?
Waters. But we do have data that allows us to, like, so at least during summertime, for instance, you know, the Kemp's Ridleys like shoals that have lots of seagrass beds for them to forage in, whereas the loggerheads, which are here every summer in large numbers, really prefer the open waters at the where like a tributary meets the bay, you know, and they're going to hang out there and that's where they're going to feed. So we have some idea with the species that are here more frequently, like the loggerhead and the Kemp's Ridley, but with the other species, they're just not, we don't have enough data as to how they use our waters because they're much more sporadic visitors, even though they come every year.
Okay. If our model is approved, is there any likelihood that should one area experience one or two takes that other areas could give up their limit?
That is something that we could ask. I mean, all of this is just, we're giving them an application and they're saying this works for us, this doesn't. So that we can certainly add that to what we're requesting in our application.
I'm not sure I'd add it at this point. Maybe if it does happen after they've approved it.
Yeah.
Because you could wind up shutting down somebody else's area if they donated a take.
It's true. Well, and that's one of the reasons why we can also reconfigure the management areas, you know, make them larger, smaller. You know, I think 7's a big ask. North Carolina currently has 6. I mentioned 7 to the woman who I'm liaising with at NOAA Office of Protected Resources, and she said she thinks that could work. You know, that doesn't seem unreasonable. I don't think we're going to be able to break it down much smaller than that, but we can break it, we can change the makeup of the areas.
All right. Any more comments from the committee?
On the, when you said talking about a regulation to force them to take observers, do you have a problem now with people refusing?
So, secondhand, I've heard that the observer program does have some difficulty in specific areas. I think most Virginia waters, they can find plenty of people who are willing. But there are just a few areas, because we need the observer trips to be reflective of the fisheries efforts as a whole. I think there are a couple areas where they are having trouble. That request was actually made by the observer program. It wasn't something we kind of brought to them. They kind of brought it to us. Is this something you would consider adding a new regulation of? Do you feel like that would be something that went over okay?
In our area, our guys take observers all the time.
Yeah.
So I don't see it being a problem, but I don't feel like they'd want a regulation that says, I don't think it would be received well. It says you have to take.
Yeah.
You know, there's some days where they're just maybe not in the mood, or there's some days they're just having an off day, and then you're going to force somebody on them.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be in favor of that, but I do know in our area we don't have problems, you know, taking observers.
If we were able to find the wording so that it was only when necessary in order to get appropriate coverage of the fishery, would that change things?
I don't. I guess we'd have to look at the wording and see how that how it all plays out.
Okay.
So, but I don't know how. Who deems it necessary? I mean, obviously you need to collect data, and it's better for everybody. But to force a regulation on them, I don't think would go over well.
Okay, thank you for that feedback. Right.
Any comments on this from the audience? Yes, sir. Please give us your name and.
Yes, my name's Charles Dryden from Bacosin, and I've gill netted for 45 years, and I've never caught a sea turtle in a gill net. And as for the observers, I thought when you bought your license that was a thing in there that if they come along and they wanted to go with you, then, I mean, if you're moving nets, like I had one call me last year, I took one like two or three times and he called me and I was going to move my nets and I just didn't have the room and I told him, I said, listen, I'm moving my nets today, just call me back another day. I mean, there might be some areas, but generally when they call a bunch of the guys I know, shoot, we just take them with us. I mean, there's no big deal.
All right.
I mean, but as for catching sea turtles and gill nets, no. I mean, I don't know what goes on the eastern shore or out in the ocean. I knew they had they had a lot of trouble back when they were trying to catch some monkfish and everything like that out in the ocean they were catching. But as for the bay, like I said, I've been doing it for like 45 years now. I haven't seen them.
Good to hear. Good to hear. Thank you very much. Anybody else? Okay, so you need us to just support your approach?
Yeah, I'm not so much asking for any motions or anything like that. I just wanted to give you an update as to where this application is and then make sure that if you had any thoughts, like, not including a regulation as of now in the application that requires observers on board or requires reporting of takes, but maybe thinking about that when we go back and we amend anything after the initial data collection period, that might be a better time. You know, those kind of things that you've told me already are what I was looking for from this.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. That takes us to Swatton Groker.
Good evening, gentlemen. My name is Pat Gere. I'm the Deputy Chief of Marine Fisheries. And if you're here tonight, since we're talking about management, it's just, we're talking about potential management. We're not doing anything tonight. There's nothing on the table yet. Most of this is coming from the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission that has been working with spot purple for a number of years, they're seeing a downward trend. As many of you have said, we're seeing a downward trend in recreational and commercial landings. So what are we going to do about it? So they've asked the states to have scoping meetings, and I thought it would be better to come in front of FMAC instead of having a separate scoping meeting where a lot of our scoping meetings we have 2 to 3 people show up. So it's great to see all the folks here, but I hope some of you are here for this particular issue. Just to give you a background on ASMFC's management on croaker and spot, the management plans were probably some of the first ones written back in 87. The Amendment 1 for croaker was in 2005. It was a complete update. There were 3 stock assessments for croaker in 2005, 2010, and again in 2017, as well as a spot stock assessment. None of those stock assessments were approved for management because they couldn't get a good handle on the discards from the shrimp fishery. None of those, the recommendations, the peer review came out, so we don't have a stock assessment per se. An omnibus bill in 2012 for spot, was trying to bring it back up to the Atlantic Coastal Fisheries Cooperative Management Act to bring it back into that level, and they also had to do that for spotted sea trout and Spanish mackerel. Addendum 1 for spot and addendum 2 for croaker brought in what's called the traffic light approach. And what that is these ugly colored graphs that I've come to know very well because I've seen them for about 7 years now. And what they are is it's just looking at the data where red is below the long-term average, green is above the long-term average, and yellow is just status quo, is okay. So when you start to see increasing red, you're starting to see declining populations. If you see increasing green, you're getting, you know, the population's getting better. What they've also done is they have two metrics that they formed. They've formed the harvest metric, which is the commercial landings and the MRAP numbers. That's what's called a harvest metric. And then they also have an abundance metric, which is made up of fisheries independent surveys such as NEMAP, CMAP in the South Atlantic, and then the Northeast Fisheries Center's trawl survey. Those are the data sets that they've been using. So in this graph, I guess Croker's on the left. This is the abundance estimate, so there's a lot of green here, you can see. Harvest, as you can see for Croker, it's getting worse. That's what this is pretty much saying. This black line across here is what's called, it's an arbitrary number set at 0.3, so 30% proportion is red. And they had two values. They had a 30% and a 60%. When it's over 30%, there's a concern. When it's over 60%, it's a serious problem. And the way it's written into the management plan right now, as I speak, is if Croker is over 3 years in a row above that threshold value of 0.3, you have to have a management response. However, both the abundance and the harvest have to agree. They both have to be that way. So it's not just your commercial and recreational catch. It has to be the fishery surveys as well. So they both have to agree. And in the case, what we have right now is, yes, we would be in a response for, we triggered the response for harvest, but we haven't done it for abundance. And here it is for spot. Spot is you have to have 2 years in a row above that threshold of 0.3, and under the present plan, we don't have that right now. And I just mentioned it's a coast-wide plan. I already mentioned the harvest metrics and what they were, and you have to exceed over 30% for 3 years for Croker or 2 years for spot. There was concern because we were seeing decreasing landings in both commercial and recreational landings, and but we weren't seeing it reflected here. So the South Atlantic State and Federal Board of the ASMFC asked the technical committee to go ahead and look at this and maybe look at revising how the traffic light approach was used. And what they proposed, which was going to be addendum two for Croker, was a regional approach where the South would be Florida and North Carolina, and the Mid-Atlantic would be Virginia Northwood. They'd add a couple of new surveys. They'd add ChessMap, which is done by our VIMS folks in the Mid-Atlantic, and the North Carolina Pamlico Sound Trawl Survey that they have in the South. And the triggers would remain at 30%, but it would be 2 of 3 years. You have to exceed that 2 of the three most recent years. Now, let me just say real quickly, this traffic light approach has been used in other fisheries as well. It's usually used in data-poor fisheries. Croker and spot are not data-poor, but it's just we haven't been able to get the stock assessment approved to get the biological reference points we need, primarily because of that bycatch issue with the shrimp fishery. We don't have – every time it comes up, every one of those stock assessments that came up, the peer review said – we still haven't gotten this done yet. It is not done correctly yet. The last one that was done in 2017, they applauded that they did a much better job, but they felt it still wasn't ready for prime time. So,
in other words, it failed again.
The peer assessment failed. It was not recommended for use to managers. So yes, you could say it. So we've been using the traffic light approach, and we've used. North Carolina uses this for their blue crab fishery, and they use it very successfully, and it's used for, I think, snow crab up in Canada as well. And those reference points, as I said, you know, results of these proposed changes in the South, it's triggered 2 of the last 3 years. The abundance has not triggered. In the Mid-Atlantic, both the metrics, the abundance and the harvest, have triggered. And that's for spot and for croaker. The South has not triggered, but it has triggered in the Mid-Atlantic. I'll show you these ugly graphs again, and I said, you can see that the last 3 years have been, for Croker, 7 years in a row been above that 30 percentile. The last 2 years have been above the 60 percentile. And for the abundance, the last three, you know, we've had a number of years, but you can see those last 3 years, 8 years in a row, been above that 30 percentile. So in the Mid-Atlantic for Croker, based on the proposed addendum 2, we would have to come up with a management response for Croker. And the same thing occurs for Spot as well. There would be a management response. The Commission South Atlantic State and Federal Board, they met in May of this year, and it was a motion to initiate this addendum and incorporate this new traffic light approach and provide management responses. But no one knew what those management responses should be. And so wiser heads prevailed, and we've postponed it. We came back in August and had some more talk, and we weren't ready because we knew if we approved this addendum, we'd have to move forward with management actions that we weren't sure what we were going to do at this time. So the motion was defeated, but the states were asked to go back and have scoping meetings, and that's what this is tonight, with the stakeholders to discuss potential management responses. So to date, Maryland, Virginia, and North Carolina have scheduled their meetings. Maryland had their meeting last week. They were more concerned about Spot. For time constraints tonight, I think I'm just going to talk about Croker. I have all the Spot information, but we've got a lot of things to cover tonight, so I'm going to go through Croker and just breeze through the Spot. What we're hoping is to get some feedback from the FMAC and from the general public. We'll probably have another meeting, discuss as well. And at the May ASMFC meeting, the states are supposed to bring what their stakeholders felt was something we could do as a management response. Okay. Just real quickly, I'm going to go back now. We're going to talk about the Virginia data, what we see in Virginia. It's a moderately, it matures relatively young, not as young as Spot, but it's, from our data, we're seeing an average age of about 4.5 years. This is the MRAP numbers, and which is the expanded numbers. These are the new numbers. The orange line is the harvest per fish. The blue line is the harvest per weight, and the black line is the effort, and they're all going down. You're seeing them all go down. The weight is going down even more. And I'll show what's happening with that in one of the next slides. Just showing when the fishery is occurring by wave. It's occurring mostly in the summer months from May through August for the most part. That's when most of it's being caught. These bars represent five-year stanzas from 2003 to 7, 2008 through 12, and the most recent 2013 through 17. This is the CPUE. The catch per unit effort. I've always said, and I stand by this, that landings are meaningless without some measure of effort. So this is the gray bars are the CPUE and number of fish per trip, and the blue line is the pounds per trip, and the black line is the average CPUE in numbers, and the blue line corresponds to this long-term CPUE in weight. And you can kind of see that, for the most part, the number of fish isn't going down that much, but the weight's going down substantially. So we're still seeing, this is recreational, this, people are still catching some croaker, but they're much smaller than they were before. And that's what we're seeing here. We're seeing about a 12% decline over time in size of the croaker. This is from MRF as well. This is not expanded data here. This is data from when you get interviewed at the dock. So this is actually raw data that when you go to the dock and somebody measures your fish, how many you have in your cooler. So it's not an expanded out. So we're seeing a decline in the croaker sizes. This is just catch per trip. It shows, how many fish are being caught per trip. And it kind of wanes down pretty quickly after you get over 20. And this is just for the last 5 years. I wanted to show the most recent trends. And this is a similar graph, but showing it by cumulative percent. So that basically you look at this graph, 90% of the trips are catching less than 20 fish.
I'm sorry.
Yes, please. If you
go back to your last one, you said the last 5 years. The last 5 years fishing for croaker recreational stinks.
Right.
So these numbers aren't,
that's what we're seeing.
Back in the 90s, you could go out there and you fill up, and guys were going, the parking lot at the James River Bridge was packed every weekend with people filling up their coolers full of croakers.
I just wanted to show you what it looks like now. Does it make sense to show something going back 30 years if it's not happening now?
That is true, but That is true, but what I'm saying is that if you presented this graph with three different time periods in it, what you would see is that the fishery, and I've been grumpy about this fishery for about 4 or 5 years now, and I'm on the advisory panel for this, as you know. And it's like I'm watching this do what gray trout did.
Tom, you're getting red. Calm down.
I know.
Well, you're right, Tom, and we can do that. We wanted to look at the most recent data. And
that's fine for.
And tonight is just to basically, you know, show what's being caught recently. And we can expand that. We can look at the data back to probably 1989, recreational data. And like I said, for the trips, what we're seeing is, 95.7% of the trips are catching less than 30, and 99.1% are catching less than 50 fish. So if you wanted to come up with a creel limit, there's a way to do that. We can look at that. Now, if you wanted to use longer-term series, we can do that as well. But it's just to give you an example.
What year is this?
This is the same time period, the last 5 years. Okay? And here's your time series, Tom, showing the decline that we've seen. We've had 29 different gears that have been used to catch croaker that we've seen in our database. We've kind of lumped them together into generalizations of gill nets, haul seines, others, pound nets, and trawls, and you can kind of see there's been a pretty substantial decline from the long-term average. The average is about 8 million pounds a year. This is commercial data now. About 83% of the harvest is occurring from those three gears, gill nets, haul seines, and pound nets, and about 83% of the effort is coming from those three. So looking at today, I'm basically just going to show information on those three gears. And here is a CPUE going back to 2000. And you can kind of see, well, gill net has been pretty much in a steady decline for the most part, what's been being caught. Haul seine is, has the highest catch per unit effort. It's bounced around a little bit. 2018 is not complete. It's shown here, but that data is obviously not complete at this point. So, and pound net has been relatively stable, but below the long-term average.
You don't have hard copies of this, do you?
I can get you one.
It's like the last one you put up. I can't see colors, so I can't
I'm sorry.
See what it's.
Okay.
That you find there.
So you can see. Yeah, I'll get you copies of it. Looking at croaker temporally, it's the same thing. The gill nets are occurring mostly in the winter months for croaker. The haul seines, for the most part during the warmer months over the summertime. And pound nets are generally most of the year. Looking at the cumulative percent again, looking at it, looking at date and when the fishery occurs. And this is this is a 10-year period. It's commercial data for the last 10 years. You can kind of see if you want to look at something, 5% of the catch for gill nets is occurring before March 25th. Haul seines, 5% of the catch is occurring before May 4th. And the pound nets, 5% of the catch is occurring before April 24th. So similar to what Alex is talking about, if we wanted to do some kind of reduction, we can look at any percentage and look at this. This is over a 10-year period. And I've looked at those 10 years. I have the graph in here. There's not much different from each year. Some years are a little bit different, but it's a fairly tight. And you put all 10 of those lines on there, they look pretty tight. So you can go ahead and say, if we want to have a 3% reduction in effort, we can go ahead and look at that and see what date that corresponds to. So these are the landings. And this is the length information that's from our biological sampling survey program that we have. And we're seeing a pretty steady decline in the last few years, about 5 years below average. We're down to about 10.1, so it's well below normal. I'm going to breeze through spot very quickly because I know we got a lot of questions, we've got a lot to go on, but spot's showing the same thing. Spot is a short-term animal, short-lived, so you're going to see a lot of fluctuations from year to year, and this is the recreational harvest. It's more of it's later in the year. It's mostly in wave 4 and wave 5. This is the same graph by CPUE. 2017 seemed to be a pretty good year for all overall. The size is going down, about 7%, but the weight is going down about 22%, the average weight. So, again, showing the last 5 years, showing where the catch is occurring. This is raw data. So it's not expanded out. So it's from what we're seeing when we interview folks, which we do about 3,800 interviews a year. And the cumulative percent, so about 91% of the trips catch less than 23 fish. It's just to give you an idea of, like, if we were going to come up, if we wanted to come up with a career limit, where we would fall with that. The landings kind of bounce around a lot. You expect that on an animal that 84% of the fish are maturing at age one. So you have, it seems like you have a really good, you know, really good population 1 year, then it's down a little bit, and it's back up the next type of thing. But it's been below average for some time. About 89% of the harvest is occurring in those 3 years, and 93% of the effort is occurring in those 3 years that I talked about, gill nets, pound nets, and all sense. And this is just showing the CPUEs. Again, it's, you know, gill nets seems to be having, you know, the biggest issue with declining catches. All seems, you know, they're all below average. That's what we're basically seeing. And then this is basically the last graph showing when the fishery is occurring, and it's basically showing the same kind of trend as it did with the gill nets in the wintertime, the hall seines in the summer, and the pound nets most of the year. And again, it's, you know, if you wanted to have a 5%, when does 5% of the gill net catch occurs before August 5th, you know, hall seines before June 5th, and pound nets, you know, before July 7th. You know, if you wanted to end the season, 95% of the catch is occurring for gill nets before October 18th. Or after October 18th, I'm sorry. The lengths, they kind of fluctuate, except for those 2 years in the early 2000s. They're fluctuating around the mean, but they've been below average about 6 of the last 7 years. So overall, generally what we're seeing, no surprise to anybody, commercial and recreational landings are declining. CPUE is declining. Okay, and it's at or below average for, you know, for our recreational data and almost all of our fishing groups. The average size and the weight are declining as well. So what are our next steps? What do we do? I mean, I came here tonight basically to make you understand what our fishery looks like. We basically told the ASMFC we'll go to our stakeholders and show our data and talk about this and say, you know, what we're seeing. So Maryland almost had an identical presentation as we had last week. They concentrated mostly on spot because that's where their issue is. We'll have further discussion on this, further review. We'll take the ideas that we have, and we'll go to the ASMFC meeting in May in 2019 of this year. And if they start an addendum process, it would have to approve those new traffic light approaches, which would be, you know, like I said, regional management, as well as putting in the new fishing years, changing it from 3 consecutive years for croaker to two out of the last 3. That process would not be completed until late, you know, 2020 if that occurs. 2020. You know, we all know what the possible, any potential management options could be. You know, size limits. You know, I talked to a gentleman today. He goes, there's no way if you put a size limit in a commercial, how am I going to do that? How am I going to call those small fish out? How am I going to do that? And what about my discards? You know, I don't think it's a good idea. Recreationally, you know, if we had a size limit, it's going to eliminate bait. You could not, if we had a 8-inch croaker and you wanted to keep that 7-inch croaker for bait, breaking the law, technically. Possession limits, you know, for commercial, for trip tickets, it would have to vary by gear, obviously. I mean, I think you're still going to have a lot of discards for some of the for some of those gears. A recreational career limit, I personally think that's something that can be done. I mean, there's a lot of ways to do that. I mean, we can, you know, some of the states have done what they call a backstop approach, where they've taken spot croaker and whiting and created an aggregate 50 fish catch. 50 fish creel limit, or we can have a creel limit on each spot croaker if we want to. Seasonal restrictions, we can do that. I mean, we can look at that. We can look at the longer time series and come up with, say, if we wanted to come up with a 5% reduction in effort, we can go ahead and come up with dates for that if we wanted to. And if there are others that anyone can think of, you know, it's open for discussion. It's right now, all we're trying to do is gather information, what people would like to, you know, if we were going to have management, what would it be? I've had several people on this board and have talked to me already. What are we going to do about spot croaker? You know, we can be proactive and do something ahead of the commission, or we can wait for the commission to do it for us. I will tell you, I'm the chairman of the South Atlantic Board, and I've taken the approach that if all the states can agree to do something on their own, then maybe we can get the commission to agree to not do anything so we can reevaluate it in the meantime. There's only a few states that have, there's not many regulations on these two species. Maryland has a size limit. I think they have a bag limit. Georgia and South Carolina have a bag limit, and that's, I think Delaware has a size limit on spot, and that's about it. There's not a whole lot. So I'm just going to open it up right now to the committee and the floor if anyone, you know, has any comments or questions.
Thanks, Scott.
Saying the size limit won't work. Maryland has a 9-inch size limit, correct?
For croakers.
So they're saying they're concentrating on spot because they don't have a croaker problem.
Their fishery is more of an issue with spot for a lot of reasons. They have a large charter fishery for spot, and it conflicts with gill nets. And so they had an agreement for a number of years that the gill nets would not go where the charter boats were going, and the charter boats wouldn't go where the gill nets were going.
Right.
And allegedly that agreement fell apart in the last 18 months. So that was the crux of the meeting.
Well, saying a size limit wouldn't work. If Maryland has pound nets and they have a size limit, how do they do it? Because, you know, it's showing gill nets have declined the most, but we've got a 2 7/8 inch mesh minimum on gill nets. That's why, and the size of the fish has gotten small. That's why the gill nets aren't catching them. Mm-hmm. The hall sanders and the pound nets are. So how do the Maryland pound netters do it with a size limit? And is that possible to do that here?
I don't know. I'll find out.
Right.
Wasn't there a species that for bait? They were considering allowing a certain number of undersized fish per boat.
In Maryland?
Well, I read about it somewhere, but is that a possibility in our regulations?
There was one species in the Mid-Atlantic where they were talking about potentially the states wanted to have an allowance for undersized, and I think it got defeated.
Really? Yeah. Okay.
And with the new stopwater approach, if North Carolina is separated out, is that good or bad for Virginia, considering our croakers migrate there in the south?
Well, in my opinion?
I think it's going to help North Carolina. It's going to hurt Virginia.
North Carolina should be in the middle.
Because they're going to grow up here, and we're going to let them migrate down there so they can catch them. So I think we need to keep North Carolina.
I'd ask about that. Why is North Carolina, and why is their fisheries are more similar to what's happening in Virginia than they are in South Carolina?
Correct, because when the spot leave here, they catch them in North Carolina. Yep. When the croakers leave North Carolina in the spring or over the winter and they come here, we catch them here. So then they migrate back and forth. So I think we have to be together with them.
I've asked the TC about that at every meeting. I said I told them I disagreed. I thought it should have been
to be equal. It has to be together.
Yep. I agree.
Anybody else from the committee?
I think a size limit's a bad idea because of the bait thing. I'm a recreational fisherman, and I use croaker for live bait. And if you said it had to be 9 inches or whatever, that'd be a long day of trying to catch bait.
Well, that's what Maryland is.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious.
Yeah, no, I understand
that. But isn't that our problem? That there's no big fish anymore. If we're killing everything when it's small, is that where, you know, because, and I pack a pound net boat, so we'd have to figure out how you can release the small fish, and I pack a Holstein boat. So, but when you hear stories of all these little fish being caught in these Holsteins and pound nets and fish pots for bait, isn't that the problem? We're killing the small fish. We're not letting them grow up.
Where are all the numbers of fish, though? So the age structure, is it a pyramid? And the largest abundance is at the zeros and the ones, and then it goes from there. So one way you could look at that on the size limit is that probably the tire comes in, Mark Chittenden came to us many years ago and pointed out that when you put a size limit in effect, if you're trying to go after maturity and get more maturity that way, you've got four age groups that might be the same size. Mm-hmm. So it kind of shoots you in the foot to try and do the size limit that way. You know, if there's one of the options there. But the other part is, it's never caught on the East Coast, but a few years ago there was a big paper coming out of Scripps Institute where they said managers had it all wrong because they're taking out the stable party population and they're leaving the juveniles, the unstable party population. And that probably is good with fish that have more longevity and more size.
Right.
Croaker and spot, I mean, it's hard to separate just about the juveniles and the adults to some extent. So, but again, I think on your point, all the numbers are the smaller size.
Right, so the numbers are there, the fish are just smaller.
Correct.
And, you know, going back to what you were saying, you used to, you know, load the boat with croakers. I never, in the 80s, I couldn't tell you what a croaker looked like. We had no croakers then, so how, there were a whole lot more pound nets back then. How did they take care of themselves and come back as strong as they were in the 90s with no management plan, and why now are they not?
They are very cyclic. It's their populations controlled by environmental factors. And the members of the ASMFC realize that, but we are seeing this downward trend, and it's like some folks on the board said, well, it's environmental, they'll recover. But if they reach a certain point, they may not.
Right. I think we've got to do something, I agree, but at the same time, then when they rebound, we've got to be able to catch them. And then it's like the trout. We're seeing great numbers of trout now, but we can't keep any. And, you know, like I talked with Rob about trying to get something, you know, our bycatch increased commercially, but there's no data because the guys killing them aren't reporting it because they're afraid to report it because they're afraid they're going to get shut down. So the fish are there. So I just want to be careful as far as putting stuff in place that when they rebound, we can't utilize them.
Well, I mean, that's why it's something like the season where we just, you know.
And that's hard, too, because it's temperature. So
right.
So you make the season from this date to this date, and it's we've got a cold snap that pushes or brings them one way or the other, then still you can't utilize them either.
Right, but I was saying this to Tom, that's the general line for 10 years. That's what the lines look like for each individual year. So they are fairly tight. I mean, you're going to get some variation. And
right.
The longer the time series you use, you're taking out that annual variation.
Tom?
So a life cycle question here. You say these are both very short-lived species, mature quickly. Are the individually spot and croaker, how big do they get before they leave the bay? It's like crabs. To me, you know, crabs in the Chesapeake Bay belong to Maryland and Virginia, and there are crabs once they get here until they're harvested or something eats them. And or they die of natural cause. But the point is, what's the deal with croaker and spot? Do they move out when they're just this big, or do they wait until they're big?
I mean, they'll move into the lower bay and offshore in the wintertime. Yeah, they'll overwinter at first. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, and then... Yeah, I know. It's just so is there something we need to do about nursery areas and bycatch for these smaller fish? And that's one of the issues I'd like for staff to look into. Well, we have, you say shrimp trawling, but Holsteins, I know you guys are Holsteiners. Yeah. Holsteins do have bycatch of these kind of fish.
Well, Adam and I have talked about, you know, right now we're doing we're doing the gill nets, we're doing the bycatch and the sturgeon work on that. We've actually talked about expanding out to, you know, the Holsteins. You know, I don't know when the last time there was a comprehensive study of bycatch and Holsteins in Chesapeake Bay, if there has been. So it's we've talked about potentially doing that.
And the other thing about these species in the bay is spiny dogfish at the mouth of the bay at the beginning of the winter.
They're in the bay. We've caught them in the bay up at Davis's Wharf in April.
I know, but they hang out right at the mouth of the bay when these fish are leaving the bay.
Correct.
And they're just eating machines.
One of the
if we could do something to catch those and...
We're having a great year on horn dogs this year. We're
good.
Are they catching them
out at the mouth of the bay?
They are.
Good.
They are.
One of the ASMSC board members during the discussion said, how do we know this is not just like weed fish? And it was dead silence.
Predation, yeah.
Right.
It was dead silence because it's like, you know, God forbid if it is. But
we're seeing a lot of small stripers in the bay.
Yeah.
You know, they're all these fish have got to be feeding on something. So
yeah.
We're protecting all the predators. You know, it'll be where a lot of them are going.
Any comments from the audience?
And I do have one more thing. In the 2000s, when croaker were really, really abundant, we had mild winters.
and we haven't had any mild. It's one of the things I watch when I'm looking for what I'm going to fish for in the spring. We have not had mild one. The winters have gotten colder in the last several years, and I think that is impacting croaker and spot a lot.
About three degrees Celsius is the mortality. You will knock them out, and you will see that. I mean, it's within straw survey. You know, they'll suddenly in December we had that cold spell, and they're catching, you know, dead croaker that big, thousand.
That's what you can do for them. Warm up.
Yeah. I mean, the Coastal River froze last year, if I remember correctly.
All right. Anybody in the audience have any concerns? Yes, sir. Please give us your name.
Yeah. I'm Mike Gunsley. I'm from the Coast, and I'm a Hall of Fame. And when fish are running small, like they have been the last 7 or 8 years, the upper of that fishery, Hall of Fame fishery, gets left because for one, it takes probably 5 men, so that's 5 families working on that one rig, and you can't work for bait. So, I mean, we don't want to catch bait either. We want to catch fish that's going to bring, you know, bring, we get $1 a carton for bait. So people ain't, you know, we're not emphasizing on trying to catch bait. But we've also tried to work amongst ourselves and with y'all doing different things to try to release these small fish. And the Hall saying it's just about impossible. I mean, the landing process before you put them in a pocket, we've gone to bigger size net to let the fish out before they get to the pocket. And you end up just gilling that full of fish. Well, then you have to pick all that, and that's one of the things about Hall saying is to try not to pick fish like a gill net, but I mean, once you gill that net full, then there, of course, no more fish is going through it. We put panels in the pocket itself, but a croaker is like a herd of cattle. Once that leader goes, they're all going to follow. So you can have a hole that big and little 8-inch croakers swimming around it, and they're just going to circle, 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 and not go out. You can take the cock line of the pocket and try to hold it underwater to let them out, and they won't go out. Mm-hmm. So the effort trying to cut back days or something like that in this fishery ain't going to work because, you know, I mean, we're doing that ourselves. People ain't going to go out there and not make money. They're going to do something else. And a whole lot, I mean, it's probably over the last, like I say, 7-8 years that it's been, poor fishing like this. It probably ain't even a third of the Hall Saint rig even fishing because, we're in it for the money too. And we've tried, you know, different things. And I mean, if y'all could come up with something, we could try, we'd be more than welcome to try. But cutting back on days or something like that, that ain't going to work because, like this man said, when they do come back, that's one of the fisheries, you know, we can get into. And like I say, I mean, you got to make money doing it.
Right.
Because it's 5 families feeding off of that one rig.
All right. Thank you very much.
Oh, so, but that's part of the problem, too, with the croakers being scarce. The price is high. So when you make that haul and you got 10,000 pounds, if you can get 1,000 pounds that are a good size and you're going to get buck and a half for it, then you're going to land that 10,000 pounds. You're going to have 1,000 pounds of good size, and the rest is going to be that scrap. And that's what we got to try to get away from in order, I think, to preserve this fishery. That's why I feel a size limit, and I'm not sure if that's the right answer or not, but we've got to get away from that somehow. Selling bait for $1 a carton, to me, is just wasting the resource. And you guys are trying to feed family, so I get it. Like I said, I pack Robert Hollowell. I pack Poundit, so...
I
feel your pain.
You're cycling in the boat, 100 pounds at a crack. It's hard for somebody to sit there and that's why you got the bycatch, little flounder and stuff like that.
It's going to be hard.
And
but we
can't lay it a pocket either because our pocket isn't like a pound net. I mean, we drive we drive our pocket poles by hand. And the way the weather is nowadays, you know, you just can't stay there long enough to cull that stuff there.
Right.
You gotta, so you'll be blowed over top of the pocket and everything's gonna go haywire. So as quick as you get to the pocket and get the boat, you know, out of there, you know, you don't want to go blowing over top of the pocket in a 40-foot boat.
Would the thing to do, Rob, would be to form a small committee like we did with striped bass and get Paul Sanders and gill netters and buyers together to try to come up with something? Would that be the proper way to go about trying to solve this?
Well, there seems to be a little willingness to, you know, try things, so that would be a bad idea to have a subcommittee.
Have a subcommittee just,
you know,
for this.
It would be a quick situation, I can tell you that.
Right.
Well, I mean, one of the old things, like you said, too, I mean, us three, we've grown up in coast, and our grandfathers and fathers before them told us that it comes in cycles.
Correct.
So,
yeah.
I've seen it, they've seen it, it's up and down. I mean, it seems like every 12 years. But, I mean,
okay. Yes, sir.
Michael Shackelford, been a commercial waterman for going on 40 years. If y'all would, I'm not much on paperwork and keeping all this stuff straight, but if you look back in the late 80s, early 90s, the crocus wasn't none. Like you talked about the horn dogs. I was one of the very first ones to sell the horn dogs, which I've been in front of y'all. You talked about a problem on it. I've been deserving my permit, been eligible for it, you know, spot for how long? I've been turned down for it. If you would look back and take your data and go back, it wasn't no crocus, but the horn dogs was, I caught 30,000 pounds a day at the end of York River Channel. 30,000 pounds a day back then. It wasn't no crocus. Well, when they started declining, look what come. We had 18 years of crocus. The horn dogs went away. I fished in North Carolina, gill net, run a net or run it down at table. Don't get it either side what I get. If I got it just right, it's not for crocus. One way or the other two nets was blowed away with horn dogs. So it's the same thing.
Right.
You go here tonight in this parking lot, y'all see 15 men with hoods on. You're by yourself. You're not going to walk toward them. You know that yourself. You're going to walk another way. I don't care what nobody says. It's the same thing going on. And you cut the dredging of crabs out. Thought that was so bad. Well, you ain't turned nothing over. Look at your decline and everything. Since day one, since dredging of crabs has cut down. You ain't turned it over. I used to fish down at Ocean View. Ocean View, you know yourself, spot. The shells is sunk. You could not get an anchor in the bottom down there. No way. You used not to. Now I can go anywhere and drop anchor because the shells has gone. What they were feeding on. You had some clammers. You had the dredgers to go down there for a little bit. Turning all this stuff over up in the bay to the stones where this stuff feeds on. If you look at your declining, everybody would look at that stuff. It's not destroying nothing. It was maybe a month or two of the year you turn something over. But everything has declined since you stopped it. And no one looks at that. I'm not a smart man. I went sixth grade of school. But I'm not no dummy neither. But if y'all would look at that and you talk about the dogfish, it's abundant. Y'all had to do something about that. So you had that. Well, I come up, got screwed over permit. Now they're blowed away. So you want to get rid of them now. Well, here I'm sitting back. Got a $200,000 boat sitting on the shore. It's cheaper to pay $100 a month to sit down there. That's where she's been sitting at. Nothing to do with it. But everything will go to every fish house and look the other business. Everybody will tell you. Everything is shut down. You talk about arsenal bed. You shoved everybody in the arsenal. Now you got too many into that. Well, everybody's been shoved into stuff. When there's stuff to do. Other stuff to do. Well, like I said, the dogs are nasty, too many you want to get rid of. That's your problem. There's so many of them, it's nothing going to come in there around them. They're not going to do it. Like I said, in the late 80s and early 90s, it was not no crocus. The dogfish was blown away. So many you could do nothing. Hey, when they went away, the croakers come back. It's just a cycle. You don't need to do nothing with it. And these talk about croakers. We will never, ever, in a haul seine, catch enough croakers in 5 years what is killed in one day in North Carolina on a shrimp frog. You will never do it. I worked on deck loads, right now down there. I guarantee you, it's deck loads. One day is more than 10 years what we will ever catch in a haul seine to do anything to. One day. You notice where all the shrimp is at right now. Everybody from North Carolina to North Carolina, Virginia line, right on down to North Carolina, the whole state of North Carolina. Right. So you take it, see how many is killed. I've done it. I've seen it. A friend of mine, these same croakers, 10 years ago, a friend of mine, he runs a 100-foot boat down there off of Jacksonville, Florida, send me pictures. She's 30 foot wide, deck loaded. Couldn't get another one on the deck of it. The same kind of croaker we're catching. This stuff is a different species. It's not what we was catching 10 years ago. It's a croaker that's the size of them. It's what it is. Until this stuff moves on and cycles back, that's what we got. But I'm not educated. I know nobody wants to listen to me, so I just blow smoke up. You know, when somebody's...
We're listening to you, Mike.
But I hope you're listening. But like I said, in front of this committee, I've been in front of it. You know it. I deserve my dog place permit. I've been eligible for it. You know how many times I've been eligible for it, Spot. And I get the same thing every time I come down here. I'm like a person sitting on death row that didn't do nothing. That's what I feel. Sitting on death row and I didn't do nothing at all. But that's why I got to sit back. Oh, no, you can't do it. Let them eat everything up. But I wish y'all would take that. Listen to someone who's done it the whole life. That's all we've done. I don't want to put myself out of business. They don't want this self out of business. That's how I live it.
That's my living. I don't want
that's
to be out of business. Either,
nobody's
so.
Going to put this self out of a job. It's planning for everybody. It's not for destroying nothing. But you got other things destroying it for us.
Right.
Thank you.
We consider you educated, just in a different field.
You.
You're welcome. Okay. Do you need anything from us? Is this just an education for us?
No, just, you know, if there's any, you know, just the thoughts of anybody, you know, we're just trying to go back and go to the commission and say what we talked about. I know Maryland's response was we don't want to do anything until the other states do something.
Yeah.
So,
and they already have a size limit, though, on croakers.
Yeah.
I think for the recreational fishery that it's a bag limit, it would be an appropriate way to deal with it, especially if the bag limit is on the order of 20 fish, 18, you know, 15, 20 fish kind of number. That's a nice mess of fish for one person. And I don't know what the statistics show for being able to have a limit that high, but that also leaves enough that you can have bait. You can have a bucket full of... You can have a live well
limit without a size limit.
You can have a live well full of bait on your boat with you and your buddy and be have a day's fishing on it. And I don't know about him, but I like catching croaker this big for bait.
Okay.
Okay. I fish for flounder.
Okay, we've got some more from the audience. Yeah.
Just agree with Tom on that.
All right, come on up if you don't mind. And
well, and again, that's going to have to be borne out by what the statistics say and what they can do. I mean, I don't know if the dockside interviews actually do give accurate distributions of harvest, assuming they get out there uniformly, which they're doing more now than they used to. And so the staff will have numbers that indicate that, yes, recreational fishermen on a regular basis will catch 40 per person. And if that's the case, then 30 may be the right number to cut it back some, but not cut it back in a draconian manner. But on the other hand, if they find out that only, you know, 0.5% of the people will catch more than 20 or keep more than 20, then it's hard to say that 30 is a good number to keep it to. But by all means.
I just disagree that if it's, you know, I do not want to see a 15-fish limit for bait.
you know, you might as well stop fishing if that's all you can take out there for bait.
Okay.
Okay.
I strongly disagree with that.
All right. It's good to know. Thank you very much. And, yes, sir.
Just for a minute here. Thank you. Will Branson, recreational angler and the president of Norfolk Anglers Club. Pat, thanks for explaining a little bit about these stoplight charts. When I saw this on the agenda, I went to the Atlantic States Fishery Management Council and to find out what's the deal, because I hadn't heard it. And I've been to a lot of these meetings and their council and commission meetings as well. I didn't understand the stoplight charts. I have a little bit better understanding now. So I went to the management considerations, the wordage, the verbiage that they assigned to this, and I'll just quote some of it. It basically says, since the thresholds, that's the harvest metric and the abundance, were not exceeded for both metrics over the last 3 years, no management response is necessary for Atlantic Croaker, and for Spot it says the same thing. And it cites that they're indicative of low harvest and high abundance in 2016. This is August of 18's data from the Atlantic States website. So I don't really understand what the issue is. If the cyclic nature of this fishery is that these fish are abundance and low, my biggest concern with the idea of putting limits on spot and croaker is I use them for bait. Sure, I've eaten some spot years ago, but they're primarily bait for me. And the idea of putting a possession limit on these things, or God forbid, a size limit, because now you've just alienated all the recreational fishermen out there who use these for cobia and for amberjack and for anything else they want to do, flounder, it creates a problem. And the other point I'd like to make is that, you know, once we give in to one of these regulations, we don't get it back. Mm-hmm. I've been coming here for years, and I've petitioned for regulations to be changed when recruitment was high and harvest was low, and the answer from Commissioner Bull was, we gave you what you wanted, we're not changing now. And that's a year later. So I'm against taking management action until we figure out what it is we have and what we might do and talk specifics. Because when they say possession limit, oh, no big deal. Well, if you put 15 fish on me, if that by boat, per day, per person, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But when I go offshore or I go south to go amberjack fishing in August, I'm not carrying 15 spot and croaker. I'm carrying a whole fish box full. And so I'm concerned about starting a regulation before we may have to. And then if it ever changes and becomes an abundance, then we're never going to get it back. And that's not what we want to be known for. So thank you.
I appreciate your concerns.
Number.
I might take 50.
50, okay.
Maybe. It depends. What you're fishing for. If you're going for amberjack, I can rip through 50. You have a life expectancy for about 3.9 seconds when you put them in the water at the South Tower. I got a 42-mile live well. But they last 3.9 seconds at the South Tower in August. You know, and for flounder fishing, you may not need as many because, you know, but it all depends. But my concern, great concern, is that once we start down this recreational possession limit, we'll never get it back. And I don't know what the right number is if you go that direction, but size limit, well, you're just going to screw the recreational community if you put size limit. Because I use from this big to, you know, whatever.
Good points. Thank you. Yes, sir.
As y'all know, I do a children's program. Been doing it for about 15 years, taking kids out on head boats and catching croakers primarily. Okay, approximately 500 kids a year, up to about 700. I've kept records over those number of years on what we caught, whatever. It averages about 4 fish per kid. Those are totally whatever on a one-day trip. I agree with Will. There's a problem with when we go amberjack fishing or whatever, you do lose a lot of the bait fish. But there's a lot of different bait fish. The average creel, though, is only 4 or 5 fish for a child. Now, there's some that's going to catch more and some less, but that's the average. Running a headboat you know, for about 10 years, most people catch four or five fish. It's not much more than that. Now, they're not real satisfied with that, but that's about what they come up with. Size limits are not what we need, though. We don't have a problem with recruitment. We got a lot of fish breeding and whatever. That's not the problem. It's not recruitment. The problem is taking in the number of fish and allowing them to get larger or whatever. If we could catch all small fish for a while, it might be great.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, you only got a 2-3 year lifespan, so you're not much you're going to do with that. My suggestion would be to take no size limit at all, and if you put a creel, and I would prefer no creel, but if you put a creel, put it reasonable 20 or 30 fish and go with that. Because Will's point, if he goes off, though, he's got six people with him or five people with him, that's 150, 200 fish that's possible. You know, that's plenty.
All right.
I tuna fish live bait, and that's plenty for tuna fish. So, well, okay. That'd be the point.
Appreciate it very much.
I just would like to point out one thing that's on that chart right there. If we were required to take a 25% reduction, which is pretty substantial, or we were trying to, that's a 30 fish limit per person. And the way VMRC writes their regulation, if you got five people on the boat, that's 150 fish.
Exactly.
And I think that now I agree that 15 is a really low number, and I can't imagine that happening.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Will's right, though. Once you put a regulation in, start one, it's just going to increase.
All right.
Just the way government works. We need your regulation.
All right, we've got one more, I take it.
My name is Mike Hubert. I'm a recreational fisherman. I'm a member of the Norfolk Anglers Club. And I'd like more emphasis put on what the gentleman in the back observed with the shrimpers and their flycatch. If they're killing so many fish down there, don't we need to find a way around their decimation? Because if they're doing such damage, isn't what we do going to be a moot point anyway? And that's really all I got to say.
All right. Appreciate it. Okay. Did you get the information you needed, Pat? Is that good?
Yeah.
We served you well?
Yeah. Thank you very much.
All right. Striped bass stock assessment?
Hopefully it's quick.
Yeah. Good evening. Again, my name is Alex, and I'm the Striped Bass Technical Committee rep for Virginia. And today I'll be giving you an update on the results of the 2018 Striped Bass Benchmark Stock Assessment.
Great.
So to recap, the last time we had a benchmark stock assessment was in 2013. And the results of that assessment showed somewhat steady declines in spawning stock biomass. We also had one of the strongest year classes that we've seen in quite a while. That's the 2011 year class. And so to preserve that year class and kind of reverse the declining trend in spawning stock biomass, addendum 4 was initiated. And we've also had a few assessment updates after that. The last was the 2017 assessment update, which actually showed a slight tick up in spawning stock biomass away from the threshold, which was good news. So in 2017, the board tasked the TC and the Stock Assessment Subcommittee to develop stock-specific reference points. And this was a big deal because the stock has always been evaluated as one stock. There's always been one target and one threshold. This would actually give reference points specific to areas like the Chesapeake Bay or the Delaware Bay. So this was a huge undertaking. It allows managers to manage stocks that they fish and also gives them a little bit more flexibility than they've had in the past. So the Stock Assessment Subcommittee developed four models. One was the two stock model. This was the premier model. This was basically the ultimate model. This gave reference points specific to the Chesapeake Bay. It also gave reference points specific to the Delaware Bay and the Hudson River combined. It also included a migration component that hasn't been done in stock assessment before for striped bass. There was a three-fleet model. This is what was used in the last 2013 assessment. There was a two-fleet model, and there was an age-structured assessment model. Essentially, numbers 2 through 4 were a backup models to number 1, the premier model. So the peer review panel, it took about 2 days, went over every model. They felt they were not comfortable. They would not recommend the two-stock model, the premier model, the first model that was recommended by the TC and the Stock Assessment Subcommittee, because they really felt uncomfortable that the model had never been used in management before. They also felt that there were some uncertainties regarding what biological reference points are appropriate when you have a population that is really mixing. So you might be managing to the Chesapeake Bay stock, and those fish may go up north to a different stock at some point. So how do you develop reference points when you have a mixing, constant mixing in a stock? And so the panel recommended one model, and that was the two-fleet model, so the single-stock two-fleet model. So in front of you, I'm going to use a cursor, is the two-fleet model that was recommended. This is what's going to be recommended and provided to the board in February. So what you see down here is the coast fishing mortality estimate. Slightly above that, we have a bay fishing mortality estimate. And what I really want you to focus on is the total estimate. This is what's going to be used to evaluate the status of the stock and how it relates to the fishing mortality threshold on the blue line here. We do not want it to exceed the threshold. That's what we don't want it to exceed the threshold. The threshold the fishing mortality threshold is 0.24. The 2017 estimate was above that. So we did exceed it. It was 0.307. So when I looked at the other models as well, the other three models, they told a similar story, that overfishing was occurring for all four models. So there is overwhelming evidence that the fishery is experiencing overfishing. We kind of scratch our heads and wonder what's going on. The biggest difference between the last assessment and this assessment is that this incorporated the new calibrated MRF estimate. So I know you've heard a lot about that. The table in front of you is specific to Virginia. We're just going to look at Virginia here. Is the uncalibrated MRF estimate from 2000 to 2017, the calibrated MRF estimate, so those were given to us after July, and then the change. So we're looking at anywhere from 2 to 2.5 times higher harvest. And so all the models are using the new MRF estimates because they're the calibrated and it's the best data that we have at the moment. So the results of the assessment will be provided during the winter meeting in February. There will be a summary that's going to be provided later this month. No recommendations have been made in terms of changes to obtain the target. Everything's still kind of preliminary at this month. I just wanted to provide you with the results of the assessment. And then, again, this will be discussed in February, and we'll know more about it at that point. So sorry to be the bearer.
I heard you mention overfishing, but I didn't pick up on the overfish.
Yeah, sure.
And I just thought that might be an issue.
No, sure. So we're looking at the F estimate and how it relates. I don't have spawning stock biomass that relates to the overfished estimate. This is overfishing. Spawning stock biomass threshold, which is not on this table, is 91,436 metric tons. The estimate in 2017 was below that, so that means that the population was overfished.
So what that means is
thought to be overfished. Overfishing had been occurring for some time. But once a stock is overfished, it signals some type of rebuilding.
Correct.
ASMSG is not part of Magnuson on the federal side, so ASMSG is not obligated to declare a 5 or 10 year rebuilding team or anything else like that. But nonetheless, to be overfished is much worse than overfishing, because you can work with overfishing by putting in management measures. So now the ASMSG somehow, we don't know yet, as Al said, we're going to have to look at the overfishing, ways to, you know, sort of curb that or take that back somehow and allow the spawning stock biomass to rebuild to some extent. So that's what's going to be going on in 2019 and 20, and, you know, probably even more than that.
That's really all I had, and I'd take any questions that you may
have. All right, I've got one. When we first started hearing about these new MRIP estimates that were 2 to 3 times higher for landings, there was some talk that that also meant that the stock had to be 2 or 3 times higher than, or somewhat higher than we expected.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was there any talk of that at these meetings?
This spawning stock biomass level did increase for that model. So it did. I don't know if it was 2 or 3 times higher, but it did.
Did it increase substantially or just some?
I think it increased some. I don't recall what the 95 SSB base model run was. I know that the model that was recommended, this was the level. This was the threshold, which was the 95 spawning stock biomass. I know it did increase. I don't know exactly how much, though.
It would be nice if we could get emailed that information.
I think ASMSC told us that the peer review, when it occurred, well, the stock assessment occurred in November. Then the peer review occurred, and then they had to write up the report. It was hoped that by right before the holidays that we would receive that report. That hasn't happened. But since Alex is on the technical committee and listened in to the deliberations during the stock assessment process, that's why we have the information we have. So we'll be getting the information. Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, I talked to the coordinator of the TC, and said the summary should be available. It's supposed to be available very soon. We don't have it right now.
Well, the piece of information that Jeff's asking for and that I think is important that we understand is, here's what the spawning stock biomass was based on the model before we changed to MRIP, and here's what it is for those historic years. Because what you want to see is, historically, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, we said the spawning stock biomass was X, and now we expect it to be X times 1.3 or 1.5, because the recreational harvest is twice what it, the new model, the new recreational harvest, looking back historically, is twice what it was, which means there must have been twice as many fish. I think the stocks are depressed. I'm not debating that. At least in the Bay they are.
Anybody else on the committee? Any questions from the audience? All right. Thank you very much, Al.
You put up the harvest. Which at the time series would be full down with the two and slides in there. So I just want to point out, I certainly remember 2003, as Tom should, through 2006, and there was a large removal of large striped bass in those years. You can follow the progression after 2007, and you see the slide in the harvest, the slide being downturned, and you can see that even the new MRIP, even though it's higher, compared to when you go back to earlier years, it's a shadow
of itself. And then we often talk about problems in the fishery, but we don't really talk too much. I did hear someone talk about recruitment tonight, but, you know, 1989 recruitment was big enough to open the fishery in 1990. 1993 was a very high recruitment, and 1996 was even higher. And then 2001, not too bad. 2003, okay. 2005, okay. 2007 was the last decent recruitment until 2011. So following 2011 was the highest in Virginia. It was the third highest in Maryland. But after 2011, it's been rather average, or maybe even below average if you try and factor Maryland and Virginia together. So there's a definite response over time for this stock. And I want to show you a couple of slides here, if I'm clever enough to find them. Now, where is the 2019 folder? That's what I'm going to ask. Anyone have a clue? Right here? Good. All right. I've got an able assistant here. There you go. Excellent. Thank you, Sarah. So let's look at this. Let's see what this looks like. So this is information related to two time periods, and we'll update that before our next meeting, because right now we have 2007 compared to 2016. I think we'll probably compare 2006 to 2018 when we're done. But you do see some situations caused by recruitment and other factors, fishing mortality rate. And what you see here in 2007, as you go across the age classes, that there's some fairly good numbers in the harvest. When we jump down to 2016, you can pretty much see that that's no longer the case, that we're much lower in terms of margin fish in our catch at age. I mean, much, much lower. And the situation is one where, you know, we've had time to look at all this information, but not to the extent where we really have put everything together yet. We just had time to put a little bit of this together for tonight. So so Adam had a plug there up here, and we're going to give Alex a plug here, because this is the same type of information. But you can see from the curves that if you follow the blue, here's 2007. It shows you the removals, the harvest. We don't even have the discards in here, and the problem with discards really is they're estimates. So the recreational fishery is 9%. The commercial fishery has some standard estimates, like 42% for gill nets, but if they're drift gill nets, it's 15%. But they're sort of scalers, really. So we just present the harvest, but you can see what's happened over time. Not a lot of large fish. Now, there are harvests of large fish occurring. I've heard about it this year. You've heard about it. And the real danger in harvesting large fish with a stock that's not robust is that you're actually accelerating the fishing mortality rate, because fishermen are very good at finding fish, and they will find the large fish. And if you were in 2003 to 2006, probably it wasn't a great hit on the stock because there were lots of large fish, lots of medium fish. But in 2016, 17, or 18, you have a situation where the fishing mortality rate is exacerbated by the fact that fishermen can find these large fish. This is to give you an idea of information. I guess, Adam, you really did this for me, so I gave you a little extra credit. Where did Adam go? He doesn't get the extra credit. He's not here. It shows you the length from 28 to 38. Now, the ASMFC has always talked about 28 inches being a coastal migrant or an age 8 fish. And even before I saw this data, since I used to work with data like this, I knew that's not the case. So what Adam produced was really an average, the mean, which is about 7.4 in age, and the median, the 50% probability there, of 7. The thing about the ASMFC is, although they call this a coastal migrant and anything larger, anyone here knows you can find large fish that aren't out on the coastal migratory pathway at many times of the year. And so it's just a rule of thumb. So if you look here, what you get is you get the weight, you know, the average weight, or 50%. They're fairly close. You get up to a 36-inch fish, you're just shy of the 20-pound fish, 36 inches. The age is 10.6. And these are the problem areas in here. This is where the decline in the population is. We don't know yet about the other states. You know, we will know that as we go forward here a little bit. The message tonight is that fisheries management has been directed to develop a maximum size for the fisheries. And that's coming from the Secretary of Natural Resources, and it's not something that he hasn't seen this information. We did send him this information today, but he's been concerned about the striped bass fishery in Virginia for quite a while. Now, granted, the new administration has just gotten to about a year of tenure. But nonetheless, this gentleman, Matt Strickler, is a VIMS graduate, and he's very science-oriented. He was worked for the National Marine Fisheries Service in a science capacity, and I'd heard it before, but now it's very clear that we are going to progress through a maximum size limit for both the commercial and the recreational fisheries. It's a throwback, because at one time we had a 36-inch maximum size limit, if you go back far enough. So that's what I meant tonight by that we'll be spending some time together, because we all together want to work this out. You know, staff has no desire to do this and then bring it to the commission. Staff wants the committee that's been appointed by the commissioner to help work on this. And, you know, that will be something that we're going to have to do a lot of. There's going to have to be a lot of effort on our part before the next meeting, which I would like it to be February the 25th, since you usually ask at the end of the meeting, and we don't have a set date, but we do tonight. And do I feel the same way as the secretary? Yes, I have, for a longer time period. You know, we often on the commercial fishery have been asked why the Potomac River Fisheries Commission has a 36-inch maximum size limit and we don't. And there have been law enforcement problems because of that difference. So I've also felt that that was problematic. I spent a lot of time on striped bass up until 2012, and really brought forward the commercial coastal fishery options that the commission adopted. So I think this is the correct thing for Virginia to do. We are likely going to get ahead of ASMFC. I'm not criticizing ASMFC when I say that the last round of reductions were difficult on a commercial end. If you think your quota gets reduced by 20.5% or 25% on the coast, not so sure on the recreational fishery, because the ASMFC has to take the interest of all the states that are involved, you know, Maine to North Carolina, and somehow get some kind of harmonious effort to get a conservation effort across the states. That's really not going to matter to us. And I'm sure there's going to be some pretty substantial input as we go through this. But Tom just hit it on the head. He said he wasn't saying that the stock wasn't in a reduced state. Okay. And so what do you do if you're not getting good recruitment? You have to do whatever you can. A manager, at least, always, and you're part of the management, always looks to promote spawning potential.
You know, you can do that different ways, and certainly a maximum limit is one way. So I know that's kind of heavy to introduce you to that, and it will send some reverberations. I do expect you to talk to your clubs and get things started. I think that earlier today I told my peers on staff, I said, tonight you're going to see some activity at FMAC, because we've had, you know, pretty calm meetings over the last couple of years, and you can see tonight that there was a lot of engagement on different subjects. So we'll be concentrating on striped bass, croaker, and spot primarily as we keep on meeting, and, you know, I hope that, you know, your assistance will be something that makes this a really good plan for Virginia. We weren't always in the ASMFC under mandates. You know, that only started really in 1993. And the true first mandate was 1995 with Wheatfish. Striped bass has always been under the Striped Bass Act since 1984. And all sorts of things have gone on with striped bass management. So, you know, we're going to be revisiting that type of a management scenario. So thank you for that. The last thing I want to mention, go ahead, because I have a little something else.
When are we looking to do something by?
Thank you. That is a great question.
And will we be looking at two different sizes for the Bay and the Ocean?
We'll have to see how the data look on the latter question, but on the first question, we're definitely looking to have this in place at the April Commission meeting.
April.
So we have February, March, and April. March will be a request for
April. BMRC meeting.
Yes. Yep. So we'll be able to have a February meeting of FMAC, March, and April. And if you notice, the February meeting is going to fall right before the commission meeting, which in the past, we did a lot of meetings that way.
You mentioned that you expect that we're going to be out in front of the other state. Excuse me.
Yes, please.
Yep.
I'm hearing that there is momentum gathering, if you will, in the other states to also implement size restrictions and potentially additional caps as it would pertain going up and down the coast rather than this one limit that we have now. Virginia's not in this alone.
Good.
Are you hearing anything similar from your colleagues at ASMFC?
No, the only thing I'm hearing is that Maryland has great concern.
Great concern because they blew
great
the quota on the small fish. You know, if you go back to the last, they were the ones that got the 19-inch limit through, primarily as a result of the charter fishery. They've gone, three times what they said they were going to be or what the estimate was?
We handed around the data, if you had a chance to look at it, that Alex worked up. Maryland's been somewhere between 4 to 8 times larger just in the harvest. To credit Virginia, we never, you know, even going back as far as the data go back, we've never been high on discards, but Maryland's had tremendous discards. So they're sweating it. I know.
Good. Let them sweat. Next, my question, do you have any feel yet for what maximum size we may be looking at?
Not that I'm ready to really jump on that. I mean, I'm really not. I want to look back at how the fishery did when we had maximum sizes, and I also want to look at our current data, because what we're trying to do, we're really trying to what would promote the best or the most amount of spawning potential, and how would that work? And so I would suspect that the data I have up here, not at the short end, because we already have a slot limit on the recreational fishery.
Yeah.
We have, you know, 1/18 and 1/18 to 28. So we can go with the modification there, but we need to look at that as well. So I'll give you an example. If you have one fish over 18 and one fish that is in the slot, 18 to 28, what would be equivalent if we changed the two fish to a maximum size?
and how would that work? So we have a lot to figure out. I mean, a lot to figure out.
I've read many places that the larger striped bass breeders produce on average of 2 million eggs. What size do they have to get to before they reach those kind of numbers?
Well, just to start out, the maturity starts out at age 4.
So at age 4...
It escalates.
Yeah, I got it.
By age 8, it's the historical studies say 95% by age 8 are out of the bay in the migratory pathway. But a lot has changed. I mean, when you have a reduced stock coastwide, then that changes the biological response. You know, there's something called density dependence, and, you know, things change with the way the stock behaves. So, you know, that's what I have, and it just was, you know, provided to me yesterday. So, now, I have heard before the secretary talked to fisheries management and said that he had concerns. And this was back when the summer flounder situation was going on, and he went into the striped bass in the same conversation. But now, you know, we certainly have a directive. We intend to follow through with it, and we're hoping that we have lots of compatriots.
So it's realistic that we're looking at a maximum size mid-season commercially?
Well, that's the way we would have to do it, but I mean, that's not good.
There's just a lot of people that lease quota.
Yeah.
So that's going to factor whether they do or they don't, and so we're talking by the April commission meeting, this could go in place.
Right.
So it could affect us in May.
It's going to be, Jill Ramsey will be working harder on allocating tags. You know, it depends, because if your average weight was low, and frankly, some of the average weights are pretty low, except the coast, you have to have a 12-pound average weight to start off with for tags.
Right.
You know, we may have to redistribute tags, we'll have to see. But you can't envision a situation where the recreational fishery, which is another good thing to bring up, starts May 16th, that you can have an imbalance in weight on the commercial fishery. So obviously, whatever we do, we'll have to start the loading in March. The other thing about the recreational fishery, the trophy fishery either has never been popular, because I remember that when the trophy fishery was started, it was sort of half the contingent didn't care, didn't want one, and half did. And I certainly know through time that the amount of fish that are recorded, which is supposed to be mandatory, as harvested, has been in the hundreds, if that. So one thing to consider, we had to raise the minimum size on a trophy fish back in 2015. It's now at 36 inches. How do you have a trophy fishery? You know, that's something else we have to talk about. And, you know, Maryland has a big-time trophy fishery, but we never had. So, now...
To be clear, you're talking about springtime trophy fishery.
Yeah.
The wintertime trophy fishery is extremely popular.
Yeah.
But, yeah, springtime, we've never cared about it.
This new information you're going to give us is going to also talk about discards, what happens to the discard rate, especially in the commercial fishery, if we cut down their maximum size. Are they going to be discarding a lot of big fish?
Well, it depends. I mean, there used to be an 8-inch required gill net mesh size for the bay. I'll have to look and see where that stands. But I remember those days where that was the way to curb the larger fish.
A maximum,
maximum
gill net size versus a fish
as well. And, you know, when you look at an 8-inch, I'm not good on them. I know a 6-inch net better than an 8-inch fish as far as how many fish are retained, but, you know, there's usually a 75% escapement of a certain size, so we'll have to look at that.
Okay.
I know if Ernie were here, because I know we had a problem with the minimum ocean being the 28-inch and needing at least a 7 or 7.5 for that 28-inch fish. But my concern commercially is you've already got guys that have their gear hung for the season. So to put a minimum on them mid-season is going to throw a curve in everything.
Well, what we're going to need to do is document anything that's problematic about this. But what's not going to be problematic is taking action.
Okay.
What's going to be problematic is what it affects and what type of remedies there might be. Because the secretary is going to want to know that. As a matter of fact, I received an email while I was sitting down here saying, please let me know what you introduced to FMAC tonight. So, you know, this is very prevalent on his mind.
I think Tom was next.
Two things. Number one, when I was talking about the spawning stock being estimated as low and it actually being higher, that doesn't mean there's not a problem.
Yeah.
It just means that if the math is if MRIP is going up substantially with what the recreational harvest is, we would expect the spawning stock to be higher substantially. It can still have a problem, but the numbers are higher. It's just a problem. The second thing is I recall that we had a slot no-take for a number of years.
Yeah.
And that we did that to improve the spawning stock and allow these 34 to 36-inch fish or something like that to actually make it into where they could be a very good, from a fecundity standpoint, fish or portion of the population. And I would hope that one of the things that staff considers, which I know is contrary to what your boss is telling you, is some kind of slot no-take for the recreational fishery. Because that will still allow us, even if it's a slot no-take up to like 46 inches or something, it'll still allow us to have a true trophy fishery.
Remember those days, and what happened was the recreational fishery was going gangbusters. So we, as a group, and we had a strike task committee, we decided to, you know, be a little bit gradual. And we did that, and part of that was the no-take slot. And then the results were that the harvest came back higher. I mean, I remember that. And it's like we're saying, well, no matter what
we
do.
But the population was going up there, too.
Yeah, no matter what
we do. Or the fish were aging into.
Well, I'll take a look at that again. I mean, yeah, that's good. So,
I mean, the real important thing is that we get the spawning, we get more, a better year of the young. And then that we get them to, we do what we have to do with forage to get them to survive. That's the two important things. And as long as, well, we're not going to talk about forage.
Okay.
Well,
I was just going to say what he said about being able to keep like a true trophy fish, I think is a good thing.
Yeah.
So maybe whatever citation size is right now for like a release citation is probably 50 inches.
44.
Okay.
Yes, I think the
so like, you know, 18 to 36 or 18 to whatever, and then
I haven't, as one of the people I know who said this one time, being called to the principal's office, I haven't quite been called to the principal's office yet, but that's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what the secretary is interested in, he's interested in not having the brood fish
at all. Gotcha.
That's the clear message I'm getting. And the commissioner's feeling that way too. So fisheries management is feeling that way very much so. But we're going to need your help, and there's no doubt about it.
All right.
And here's the other thing. Someone said tonight, made a big speech about, and I think I knew who it was, made a speech about once you get a regulation, you know, I think it was Will. Will, are you back there?
Yep.
All right, there's Will. Once you get a regulation on the books, you don't. But I think here's a situation where one of the things we need to point out is whatever happens, we need to know that moving ahead does have an endpoint once we have also complied with whatever the ASMFC does. So if the ASMFC, we're still part of the ASMFC, whatever the ASMFC decides later on, if we're in a situation where there's no overfishing, stock's not overfished, then we want to document that we want the ability to modify this regulation. And if you do that, that's good. The problem with regulations being on the book is when they're put on the book, no one takes the time to tell this commission here, well, you know, really, can't you relax that? Now, I know you had the example from Commissioner Bull on that, but, you know, generally, it's how much emphasis you put on everything. And I know this day is different than 20 years ago. I can tell you that because of the hearings we have here for ASMFC where, you know, the attendance is more than ultra light and things like that. And I know everyone's busy trying to make ends meet. But at the same time, you have to make emphasis. People have to show up to the commission meeting and give their input right there. I mean, that has to happen.
All right.
So,
Robert?
I have one more. What do you expect to come out of ASMFC in the February meeting? What do you expect to see happen, if anything, relative to striped bass?
February is going to be a review of the stock assessment. It's going to be a review of the peer review. It's going to be debating and deciding whether an addendum needs to be done or an amendment needs to be done. An addenda can be done in 9 months. An amendment is more like a year and a half. A public information document could be started. And then at the same time, all the states that have questions can have the technical committee go to work answering those questions by May. And then in May, it starts to be, you know, working on whether it's the addendum or the amendment. But in either case, it's not a short route.
Understood. Don't expect any corrective action. You don't expect any action other than review.
That's right. But what you're saying earlier, if I may, about the other states, I'm not going to point any fingers as to what caused all these problems coastwide, but the northern states, they get pretty adamant about, you know, battening down the hatches.
I understand.
You know, you go Maine, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, they get pretty adamant. Yeah. So.
We had another question from Mark.
On the commercial side, we have a size limit 25th of March.
Right.
You'd be surprised at how many fish I discard that are dead because they're not less than 28 inches.
Yeah.
Well, I have a quota. Why don't you just let me catch my quota and get out of the fishery?
Well,
I mean, if I get a 2,000-pound quota, I end up catching 3,000 to 4,000 pounds to get my 2,000 pounds the way y'all got it set up.
I mean,
I can't stay in the conservation. I throw a 40-pound fish overboard.
Like you. In other words, you would do that. We have to know that others would do that as well. And as I said, when we meet again, these are the kind of things that staff will be paying attention to document and relay back through the commissioner to the secretary. That's a good idea.
Okay.
So it goes from March 26th to June 15th.
The next thing is all of these fish in Virginia are spawning in Catfish County.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the catfish are eating up probably 3/4 of the spawn. And you keep dragging your feet. You don't seem to want to do anything about the catfish.
We need to increase the process.
George was in here a little while ago. I was hoping I could bring this up while he was in here.
Yeah. We need to increase the processing sector. The market sometimes isn't that great, from what I hear. It's not constant, but it can be good. We've taken over 2.5 million pounds out last year, which is a pretty big bump up from...
And a drop in the bucket for what's out there.
Drop in the bucket, and while you worry about the rockfish spawn, I worry about what's already happened to shad and the river herrings.
The catfish eat them up.
Many
I'll tell
years,
you what happened to
many
them.
Years.
Okay.
So,
yeah, old Jack Favre said 15 years ago we won't have nothing.
Here,
the catfish are going to eat them all up.
Here's the situation I keep waiting for. The public has yet to exert itself about blue catfish the way they should. The public needs to...
I'm not concerned about the public. I'm concerned about our fishery.
Well, you need the public to help this invasive species be knocked way back. You need them to get adamant about it.
Thanks, Scott.
That's the way society is, I think.
Just to...
Everyone has a legislator.
Real quick note, the pound netter that fishes at Kiptopeke had this December striped bass fishing, probably caught a dozen and a half blue cats.
Wow.
Southern end of the, right there at Kiptopeke, Ed Brady, he had a 5-pounder one day.
Well, Vims is doing a study right now down the lower James of predation on, they're looking for crab, they're going to find plenty of them. Eventually, little by little, we get enough of the public engaged. You need that to happen.
Okay, we can do
eventually
that.
We won't have any other fish, so it won't make any difference.
All right.
You keep dragging your feet. They keep eating.
All right, sir. Appreciate it.
Okay.
That leaves the MA.
All right.
Pardon?
I think you have...
Yes, please. Sorry, didn't ask the public.
I'm Mike Avery again, and I am all in favor of conservation measures if the stock assessment shows that our striped bass are in trouble. I support all of that, but what I strongly oppose strongly oppose, is Virginia taking unilateral action for just one state to take action to conserve the stocks. This fishery is a coastwide stock. There's anglers up and down the coast targeting striped bass. For Virginia to take action to try to conserve striped bass fishery is only a drop in the bucket in what we will conserve compared to what other states, both in the Bay and the coastwide stocks, are doing. What I recommend that BMRC do is go to ASFMC and come forward with a plan to conserve striped bass fishing and not take unilateral action. And I would recommend that this committee adopt a position to tell BMRC you do not support unilateral action on striped bass. You support a coastwide plan to conserve the stocks. And it sounds to me, Rob, that if your direction is coming from Matt Strickler, what I have a note to do now is turn the attention of the recreational anglers, the thousands that I can muster, away from BMRC and towards Matt Strickler. If this guidance is coming just from his office, that Virginia take unilateral action, I can promise that his office will be flooded with cards and letters and phone calls telling him to not take unilateral action. My recommendation is a coastwide plan, and I recommend that this committee tell BMRC that we need a coastwide plan, not a single state plan. That's my comment.
All right. Thank you very much.
So I think that's a good comment, but given the circumstances, there won't be unilateral action. It just will be a delay.
Okay.
We're going to work forward on it.
Can I ask Rob one more question?
Tom was next.
Rob, I know you can make motions at ASMFC, or I would suggest that you make a motion at the February meeting. You point out that Virginia is looking at taking substantial measures and that you get a vote that says whatever we do will count against whatever they impose on us next, so that exactly what you guys are saying, that they don't come in and say, oh, look, you guys said nothing over 36. Well, now you still have to take another 20% on top of that. And if I think you can make a motion that says this is what we plan on, what our intention is, and any changes we make will apply kind of retroactively.
I think we have to keep it at that right now because we're not going to have enough time before
That's right. You just say we're going to make measures, and that anything we do, any reductions they do are based on historically what we had up until before we made those changes.
Well, looking ahead, I would think the way you do that is to write it the first part. That's just sort of a placeholder. But the second part is sending out our own reduction plan to the technical committee, where we exactly show what the conservation values are.
Right.
So that's the second part.
All right.
Was VMRC directed to take something in to the ASMFC February meeting on striped bass?
No.
Is VMRC planning to review its plans with the Striped Bass Management Board at the February meeting?
No, because we won't have it ready. I mean, that's like February's.
So in other words, we're not going in with any placeholder.
The only thing we're going in is pretty much what Tom said, I think is a good way to start this off. We're going to have a management plan of conservation for the reduction in fishing mortality rate to attempt to boost the spawning potential. And we want to make sure that the ASMFC recognizes that if that's different than the impact that they expect later on, or what they expect later on, that counts towards that. Now, I still have to air this off my chain of command.
And you're going to review that with us at the February 25th meeting?
The results.
Yeah, okay.
That'll be after the ASMFC. But what we have, I think February 25th, we'll have some of the information ready. So you can go forward with this.
All right. Like I said, Mid-Atlantic Council review. The next item is a Mid-Atlantic Council meeting review.
Yeah, I think the easy thing there, if you don't mind, is to give you a handout. These are, in effect, past actions by the ASMFC, and then I'll talk briefly about the Mid-Atlantic Council situation. But these were the addendum 31 and addendum 32. We had a public hearing here in late November. The ASMFC was here. We just had a couple of folks here. But they really involved the recreational fisheries and summer climate and black sea bass. And when you look through those, next time if you have questions, we can talk about it. I mean, one thing that is apparent to you from John, from your question earlier, the ASMFC switched the way they deal with the recreational black sea bass fishery, got rid of the allocation that they had in place, and now set the specifications, and then, you tell them what your expected harvest is, they'll review it, technical committee, and they'll see if that's in keeping, and that is the reason why the February fishery has to be counted against the regular season that we went forward before. So you'll see that right in there. The only thing I want to tell you about the Mid-Atlantic Council, and it's on summer flounder, but it's commercial. And so the commercial amendment has been in the works for probably 4.5 years. And it hasn't been able to get much headway. Options have been proposed. Essentially, New York does not like the amendment. And New York wants to have a negotiated quota where they have handed me and other people on the council, paper that says Virginia gives 2%, North Carolina gives 3%, Rhode Island gives 1.5%. I mean, that's the negotiated quota. And so we spent from 9 until 11:45 on one motion at the last council meeting. We never got to the amendment and what was in it. It was all about New York, and everyone was in huddles. We had different huddles in the room to try and figure out what the heck we were going to do. And in the end result, New York wanted to essentially freeze everything the way it was, don't do anything, and
what they want is to have their options go forward. Well, when you have the ASMFC and the Mid-Atlantic Council together, the motions and the votes have to be the same conclusion. Otherwise, it fails. So their motion failed, and because it failed, it meant it kicked the can down the road to this February meeting, which will be held in Virginia Beach at the Hilton, and we have to start all this over again, because the only thing that happened from that day is in New York, instead of being able to send a proposal to the staff of the Mid-Atlantic Council and the staff of the ASMFC, they can't do that. Now they have to send the proposals to the states, and then we start it all over again. And there's a lot of talk about lawsuits, which you have heard, Jeff, in the past. And I think one of the better comments was that one of the New York people said to me, well, yeah, okay, so they didn't report back in the 80s, and they didn't do this, and they didn't do that, but that's a long time ago. We've got to forgive and forget, because the allocation was based on the 80s. And so, you know, probably rightly so, New York had a much bigger fishery than the allocation shows, but they didn't bother to report it. And I understand that. When we had our striped bass fishery start up, we were held to 20% of the commercially to the 1972 to 1979 landings in Virginia, and they were poorly reported. And folks got very upset back then. Mr. Wigley may remember some of those times. But, you know, it's a good thing to report. So we'll go through that again. The Mid-Atlantic Council will eventually bring the recreational options in play now because of the MRIC change. And so, you know, after they get done with the commercial amendment one way or the other, either status quo with no change or some kind of changes, then they'll start working on the recreational options for summer flounder.
But again, with the summer flounder, are they going to look at addressing the split?
The what?
Are they going to look at addressing the 60-40 split?
Yes. That is part of what will be addressed. And there was an economic analysis 2 years ago, and now there's another economic analysis. The last economic analysis showed that if you move a few percentage points either way, economics aren't as good. But now, with the way things are now, I mean, it's different. So we'll have to see. So, yeah, and I encourage you, anyone to come down to Virginia Beach. It's on their website if you want to look. It starts the 10th of February.
All right, thank you.
Agenda.
I'm sorry. Please.
I'll get run out of town if I don't ask you this. What are your plans on a herring or anything?
Well, Pat, would you mind telling Mr. Wigley the herring plans?
Any type of season. He was at the meeting we had up in Providence, Florida.
We're working on our sustainability plan. And that sustainability is not done yet, so it has to be seen as an
Will that include a recreational season?
It's mainly,
that's pretty much what we were talking about.
But we still need a sustainability.
But you're paying him to do all these studies, so he'll never finish. You know how that works.
If we have a sustainability plan,
I would have said that.
If we have a sustainability plan and we open the fishery, then we have to monitor it. So it's the money, the grant money would have to perpetuate. We have to do a juvenile survey and then an adult survey if we're going to open the system.
But thank you for showing.
Did too good a job, they fired me.
All right, Lewis, you're going to do the fish towing. And how much time do you expect that to take?
I was going to ask Rob if you distill it down without the
Before Lewis does that, I mean, a lot of activity, I'm not kidding, is going on. But the commissioner told us there will be a regulation prohibiting this, and it will happen quickly.
Okay.
So we're going to be on the agenda for January 22nd, asking for a public hearing in February. And Lewis is the one who's most attuned to the situation. So he just today worked a little bit on maybe what to go forward.
Okay.
Thanks, Ron,
for setting the table. I had more background information I could provide. I'm sure any of you that followed social media or looked at the, when I saw the paper on the front porch Saturday morning, I looked down and there was a striped picture of a striped bass that was being towed. So, I mean, it's definitely out there, fish towing, and that really exploded in the month of December this year. I think it was primarily due to what I call creating a value-added product by towing these fish. Some folks figured they could add some water weight, which in a four-money tournament was a business model. And it definitely got publicity. Anyhow, like Rob said, the commissioners requested this, and it looks like when I took a quick look at it, we could wrap this into the regulation that prohibits snagging and at the same time prohibit the towing of fish. And really, it boils down to the definition of what towing a fish means. And that here, I looked at kind of the background and what prior had occurred. And so this is what I have for you to think about and make any comments. Towing a fish means a cable, rope, line, or other similar material with one end attached to a vessel. And yes, if someone's holding that and in the vessel, that would be an attachment. The other end secured to a harvested fish and placing the fish in the water when the engine of the vessel is running and in gear.
Mm-hmm.
So it is with an engine. So if I'm in my rowboat and I have fish on a stringer,
kayak, fish in a stringer,
that's okay.
Or someone anchored, which is kind of a normal process.
Is you pick them up if you're in a boat, you pick them up before you
pick them up, put them in the boat when you're going to move. In a kayak, that's not a problem, although I liken it to towing a bucket. You don't want, when I paddle the fish, I wouldn't be dragging fish.
But when I fish around shorelines, if I've got a fish on a stringer, I'll paddle three strokes, fish a little bit, paddle a little bit. I mean, it's not serious paddling, but
within
if the rule doesn't allow that, then it would be painful.
Any comments you have on what I just read you?
No, just so long as it says motor running, that's fine.
I think
in gear.
I do have a comment. Did you say just stripers specifically or just for all fish?
Fish. No, because we do know with the one fish possession limit for cobia, apparently some of this did occur. Historically, in cobia fishing, it would occur for a boat that's anchored and they're chumming. It wasn't unusual to tie a fish out, leave them alive. By some thoughts, it would actually attract more cobia. But it's not really doesn't present that great of a additional mortality threat, although I would agree that fish is being stressed to some degree just being on a stringer. But I think it was to address the towing of fish situation. And so it occurs because of that one fish possession limit, it did occur during the cobia season, and particularly when, again, you've got a four-money tournament.
Well,
so it could be more exclusive to just right now maybe those two species of fish, but that would be a comment we would.
Well, I would say the one thing is if it's a shark and you're towing it backwards with the intent of killing it, is something that is done occasionally. I mean, that is the only thing I would be concerned about you know, I think it's done with the intent of keeping the fish alive. And if it's done, if you have a shark or something that you're trying to kill by towing it backwards, it's sort of the opposite idea.
Because you're going to boat the shark, and rather than just shoot it or however
Correct.
Dispatch it, you don't want to put that live critter in the boat.
Exactly. So they're something that some people do. So
could you?
What it doesn't address, and I point this out to you, on rare occasions, an angler will boat a fish so large, maybe a swordfish or a tuna or even a shark if it's one they can keep, and they can't physically get it in the boat or it wouldn't be safe, and they'll lash it to the side normally rather than tow it. And this wouldn't really allow for that. But I don't know how much of an issue that is, and it's only going to be in state waters. I recall there was one tournament where maybe it was a Grady White Open or something. They had a large big eye and they could, small vessel, and they couldn't get it in the boat. Didn't have the people or whatever to get it in the boat, and they towed it most of the way in and then put it on another boat to bring it in. But this would only apply to state waters.
Could you use underway instead of with the motor running? If the vessel's underway?
Oh, and in gear. So now you're moving the vessel with the end.
It doesn't cover paddling if that's all you've got.
Well, that's what he said. They don't want it to cover paddling.
Well, do they?
I think it is a bad idea to cover paddling because as a rowboat and a kayak-type fisherman from time to time, you will put fish on a stringer, and you will move short distances with those fish in the water. When you're going a long way, you'll pull them in the boat, but you don't always want to pull them in the boat because you put mess in the boat.
That's not really underway, though.
It is.
If you're just moving from one spot and you're drifting around it. But I just want to make sure we cover everything and consider everything because this is ridiculous.
If it's striped bass and cobia mainly, can we just make it for those two species? That way everybody else is covered, your sharks, your tunas. You know, you say just for state waters, if you catch a big fish offshore and you can't get in the boat and you got to tow it back to the dock to get it in, then you're bringing that fish into state waters.
Right.
So can we just make it, would it work just to make it
you
striped
can
bass specific?
That's right. These are all just suggestions. We're not going to settle it tonight, but these are good points to bring up and things that we have to consider. Just a minute, please. Yes, John.
I was going to say we have a comment that.
Was that a regulation that's already on the books, or is that what you're proposing?
Yes.
They were directed to propose.
I was going to put it in the current snagging of fish regulation. That is prohibited.
I thought just to add.
Before we go any further, is there anyone in the audience that agrees with this procedure, towing a fish or roping a fish? Let's come on up, please, because it's got to be on the recorder.
I definitely don't think it should be allowed for live fish, but I know some people will tow a fish to bleed it out, so you don't want to. You may want to include that so that's still allowed.
Which goes with the thing about a shark or a tuna.
Right.
In this, I mean,
right.
Tuna's not in state waters, obviously, but yes.
But this is done in state waters. I mean, cobias often are tied off and cut and bled out, you know, so that the meat's better, and you don't want to restrict that out. I mean, it's.
Right.
But are you dragging the fish through the water with the motor running when you do that?
Yeah.
Okay. All right,
not
so
me,
that's.
People, I mean, people, yeah.
Another point to put on the list. All right, any other comments?
Well, just the comment that when you talk to law enforcement, they indicated that the way they look at that, that's your possession, part of possession. Because part of this was also, was there any sort of hydrating going on?
Yeah.
Saving a fish for a bigger fish, and law enforcement just says, part of possession.
If they happen to come across them while they're towing it. Yeah, but that doesn't mean they won't drop it off later if they catch a bigger one. Yes, sir.
Will Branson here. When I read this, and I only recently saw this on social media, and I've never seen it in practice. In fact, I didn't even hear about it until I saw it on social media. You know, you bring up one I didn't think about, sharking, you know, shark fishing. I know it's in federal waters, could be in state waters, but, you know, that would apply.
Not with a mako.
Not with a mako or a thresher, you know. And but what comes to my mind is the Citation red drum, the large red drum. Now, sometimes you catch them on anchor and you've got enough drift by the boat, but sometimes you're drifting and there's not a lot of current. And I use a lip gripper and a piece of line, and I bring the fish alongside the boat and keep the boat moving just enough with the motor in gear, underway, making way, and that would now be illegal for me to do that. And red drum is not one I'm planning on keeping because you can't, but, you know, if it's in the slot size, it's in the box. But the large Citation drum or black drum, I don't eat the large black drum, same release procedure, you know. Lip grip them, tie them off to the side of the boat. If there's enough current with the boat not moving, like at anchor, okay, no problem. But sometimes you're drifting around and casting for them, and that's the primary method I use to release these large red drums because it takes 20 to 30 minutes to revive these things.
Okay. Are we getting all of these suggestions?
So somehow to differentiate, I understand the intent, and if it's targeting to strike bass or to cobia because of tournament, then kind of work it toward that if that's the problem. You know, work it toward that problem. I know it'd be nice to have a general, you know, administrative code to cover everything, but, you know, state waters, red drum, black drum. In federal waters, it's shark, you know.
Okay.
And so, you know, that's my point, is that you got to make something that fits. And if the problem is cobia tournaments or, you know, striped bass tournaments, and there's a provision about mutilating the fish, well, I don't know what this looks like, okay? Max, maybe you can explain what the, you know, because you did something on with this experiment. If there's an obvious mutilation of the fish because of the internal organs or the gills or however it's washed out,
mm-hmm.
then there's something that you might want to focus on, because then there's clear evidence. When I think about striped bass, there's a gaff prohibition. If you bring a striped bass in your boat and it's got a big hole in its lower jaw, I know you could have measured it on the boat. I don't know if anybody would, you know, hook it under there with a small scale hook, but if there's obvious that it's been gaffed, well, that's already a violation. So,
mm-hmm.
I don't sure how, you know, you want to use a sledgehammer to fix a problem in two fisheries. I'm not sure that's the right procedure, but I'm in favor of doing something. I just caution about what we want to do.
That's
for
why
two species.
We want to get all the different angles that we have to look at. Tom?
So, and I know this is going to sound stupid, but... So, read the regulation about how you're holding the fish. So, I'm holding... I'm trolling. My motor's in gear and running. I've got a rod in my hand, a lure on the end. I hook the fish. I'm now holding the fish in the water while the motor is running and in gear.
But it's not really in your possession yet, although I guess you could have that.
You could do the same thing by hooking a real good hook in there and then just dragging the fish along. I mean,
right.
Yeah. So, I mean, somehow you have to be careful on how you do that, how you state this. So
that's why our officers, up to their discretion. I think that would be because I don't know how you could write
that
into it.
Yeah,
well, but there's always that
loophole
or attempt to.
I know this cop that used to be in Virginia Beach.
All right, yeah, please.
In my opinion, we shouldn't be focusing on this being specific for adding weight in a tournament because I operate a tournament and I run a tournament. I think it should be incumbent upon the tournament to put this in their rules and make this an obvious disqualification.
100%. But we, our commissioner.
I'm sure there's, I mean, I saw the social media stuff too, and there was all these, I mean, strange reasons that I thought that people were coming up with for why they do this. I agree that it's not something that should be going on. But,
okay.
But I think it was, yes.
So.
I think next year, if the commission did choose to do nothing, I think you will see those tournaments they'll fix it for the individual tournaments because they write their own rule. Every tournament has rules, and they would make the rules.
Right.
And it could be as very specific if they see a poke hole in this area, but
it's
poking somewhere else and get the same results maybe.
We pretty much have been instructed to do something about it before next year. So, Robert, you had a comment?
If you go high grade a fish, dragging it behind a boat is a whole lot more feasible to keep it alive than it is putting it in a cooler. So actually the fish has a better chance to survive if you are dragging it. Now if it's gaining weight, that's up to the tournament director, not up to VMRC.
True.
We don't set rules for the tournaments.
Well, when I say tournament, I mean these are private for money tournaments. That's what I think drove the bulk of this for this month of December was striped bass. Some number of people figured out they could add weight to these fish by dragging them for a few hours and go pretty much undetected.
John, did you have something?
Yeah, what about the guy that's not fishing a tournament that has a small boat but and literally doesn't have room for a 50-pound fish? It's now it would then be again he couldn't drag that fish in anyway.
That was the lashing the tuna to the side of the boat discussion we had earlier.
Well, I would think there's very few people that would have what boat could you add 50 pounds to? If you're out in a boat and it's going to go under,
I'm not going to put a 50 pound striped bass that's still green in my boat.
No.
Yeah,
a kayak. All right.
Well, that's what the gentleman said earlier. Why use a sledgehammer to fix it? Small problem.
I the clearest message I heard from you is yes, you think it's a problem too, and it should be specific to the fish that were involved, cobia and striped bass.
All right, anything else from the audience?
No, no, yes.
Just, yeah. Okay.
I started all this mess.
Thank you.
Okay. Hello, my name is Max King. I'm owner of Captain Max King's Marine in Virginia Beach. I've been targeting these striped bass for over 20 years. And most of the time, come December, I've got an eel rag in my pocket, and I'm close to Cape Charles, okay? And I've been troubled by some of my fellow striped bass anglers on how they retain their striped bass and after they catch them. These anglers are catching striped bass that have been swimming for over 15 years. They put it in the boat, and the first thing they do is cut a hole in it and put a rope on it, mooring line, one you tie a boat off with, and then tie it off to the cleat and throw it overboard. Most of these boats now, eeling for rockfish, are trolling around at 1.5 miles an hour to 3.5 miles an hour, either with the current or against the current. The weather in December is not always pleasant when you're striped bass fishing. As always, it seems like there's a little bit of wind, and there's always a few bumps in the road. And these fish that are being placed on these mooring lines are put through a lot of stress. Okay? Now, my primary concern, it ain't about the money in tournaments or anything else. It's about these rockfish being towed around. And the first fish you catch of the day is 35 pounds. And that was your big fish for the day. And everybody catches a bigger fish than you. Towards middle of the day, after 3 or 4 hours of towing around, you catch a bigger one. And you walk back there and you untie that mooring line and you let that fish go. That fish has little chance of survival. It's going straight to the bottom. Okay? I'm kind of got off script there. Sorry about that. You know, when I see these other anglers catch fish, I'm excited for them. But for reasons, I mean, this is an epidemic over there. 25% of the boats over there are towing fish around. And when they catch a bigger one, they're just releasing these fish. I mean, all day long, the boat catches their big fish limit. And they look back. And Bob, your fish is really small. Max, your fish is really small. Catch a bigger one. What do you do with that smaller one? You toss it back. Stripers are protected by a no-gaff rule in Virginia. Should not be allowed to catch a striped bass in Virginia, and the first thing you do is cut a hole in it. It should be unacceptable. And you shouldn't be able to release the damn thing.
Thank you.
This tying fish off to a boat has gone on for years, especially while drift fishing for eels. Okay? But the last 4 or 5 years, everybody's put the boating gear and are trolling these eels around with planer boards. So now you're dragging your catch around with you. Some anglers are claiming that slow trolling eels catch bigger fish. Okay? I've even heard on the radio, I don't have a citation now, but I will by lunchtime. It seems to be better that you catch a 50-pound fish plus than when you actually caught it at 4:30. I mean, at 9 o'clock in the morning, you caught a 45-pounder, but by lunchtime, it's over 50. See, here in Virginia, striped bass actually gain weight after they catch them. It's the only state in the East Coast that does it. A lot of fish are being released in December or just swimming to the bottom and dying. Do you think it's okay to cut a hole in a 15-year-old rockfish, put a mooring line through that hole, tow it around for at 1 to 3 miles an hour, and when you catch a bigger one, you just let the fish swim to the bottom? Do you think it's okay to cut a hole in a 38-pound striper, drag him around until it gets above the 40-pound minimum for Virginia Saltwater Fishing Tournament citation? Do you think it's okay to cut a hole in a 48-pound striper, drag him around until the fish gets above 50 pounds, just so you have bragging rights that you're in the 50-pound club? Do you think it's okay for me to catch a 70-pound striper, drag it around until he gets above the state record? What would y'all do to me if I brought that fish to the scale? There are idiots out there. Striper fishing, they think this is okay. The ethics is not there. Only in Virginia you can catch a striper, and several hours later, the fish weigh 8 to 12% more than when you caught it earlier. Please, please do something to prevent killing these fish and mutilating these fish that I love to catch. All right, I'm better.
I hope.
Any
so.
Questions for me?
No, I don't think you've got a single person in here that doesn't agree with you. So.
Thank you. I've taken a lot of heat because of this.
Well,
okay? My business is taking a lot of heat. I walk down to my boat and see three mooring lines taken off my boat instead of all four of them on there. It's bull crap.
I agree.
And you're right. Striper tournaments can make rules and make the change. And after what I saw at the Mid-Atlantic Rockfish Shootout, where the first place and second place guys cheated everybody out of their money, and the tournament director just sit there and idly by and let it happen, I made it happen in Pigzilla. I took a lot of grief for it. And what did I say? About 25% of people are dragging fish around. Guess how many people I had in Pigzilla complaining? About 25%. Because all of a sudden, they're not as competitive. They're catching the same size fish you are. But they can't drag it around and make it better.
Hmm. We had no idea it was this commonplace. Or at least I didn't. Many of us. Most of us had no idea it was this commonplace. I'd never heard of it before.
This year it became very apparent to me what happened with the Mid-Atlantic Rockfish Shootout and all that stuff. I investigated a little bit and found some really good friends that drag fish around that they've been doing it for 4 or 5 years. You know that fish weighs more. The fish looks totally different when you caught it and hold it up. The fish is completely full. The belly's full. The stomach's full with all the water you just drug around. And now you want to take away and put a max limit on striped bass? It's probably because we screwed it up.
All right. Appreciate
they, these guys sit down and say the blessing and then go right out there and drag that fish around. It's bull crap.
Lewis, is there some way we can expand this to cover all kinds of high grading? I know we had a commissioner on this commission years ago that talked about how if he was out striper fishing and he caught a bigger fish than the one he had in the cooler, the one in the cooler was going overboard. After a meeting in this hall right here, if consider while we're doing this, if we can address high grading altogether, please.
Live wells.
Also, when you talk about bait and tackle shops that are weighing fish for saltwater fishing tournaments, mm-hmm. if they put a rule out that says it's a mutilated fish, well, I went to you know, Billy Bob's Bait and Tackle, and I bought my eels there this morning, and I'm going to take my fish back there to get it weighed, but I'm going to drag it around, and they disqualify my fish because it's mutilated. Well, guess where I ain't going to buy my eels anymore? You know, it's a tough situation, you know.
Could the same thing be accomplished with a hose? With a washdown hose?
Washdown hose.
Could the same thing be accomplished with a washdown hose?
Sure.
The rule in the tournament, any tournament you fish, thou shall not cheat.
Of course. Yeah, I know that. I agree with you. So,
I think with a hose, you can add water to them, but I think the fish needs to be alive because I think that sphincter muscle for the stomach will stay closed. And if it's dead at the dock and you use the hose, I don't know.
Okay, I'm just curious.
The way these guys operate, the fish is alive, they take a garden hose and fill it full of water, and they keep the head elevated, and they take it to the scales, and they don't never worry about it until after the fish is weighed, and after the fish is weighed, they just run away from it. And then all of a sudden, a dock cart that didn't have any water in it at all has a gallon of water in it. Okay? When I did a little test of dragging a fish around, my fish gained 4 pounds in an hour. And it's just, when you went to that sphincter muscle and you penetrated it the first time after dragging it around, water sprayed off like you busted a garden hose. That fish is trying to retain that water. And that's what these guys are doing and torturing these fish. It just shouldn't happen.
Stick with us because we're going to address it real quick. If you got one more, we got somebody here that has to travel a long way.
My name is Jerry Hughes. I live in Chesapeake. I'm a member of a lot of the fishing organizations in the area. I also do a lot of fishing. In December 14th, I caught a 50-pound, 6-ounce striper at buoy 38. I was drifting. My boat is only an 18-foot boat. There was no way I was going to keep that boat, that fish in the boat, and I'm going to keep him fresh. I put him on a rope, and I put him on the side of my boat. Now, I drifted down to buoy 36. When I turned my engine on, that fish came back in my boat and went back to buoy 38. When I got to buoy 38, I cut my engine off. That fish went back in the water, only to keep him fresh. Now, we mentioned cobia. Well, I do a lot of fishing in cobia in the summertime. At 12-mile marker, I anchor up there, and I do a lot of chumming. If I catch me a 40-inch, it has to be 40 inches, and I'm going to put him on the side of my boat because I want him to stay fresh. He's not my live well is not big enough to put him in it. I don't see nothing wrong with that, and I hope that you don't take that away from me, that the ability to keep that fresh, that fish fresh. Because in the summertime, you know, you're out there at 90 degree with temperature. I'd rather have that fish in the water, keeping it cool and so that I can take it home and enjoy it. Please don't take that away from me.
We'll consider that. Well, you might want to consider a larger cooler. Yes, sir. John?
I don't think that was part of what he said. As long as he's drifting, that fish
Correct.
Is in the water and he's drifting, would it be okay?
Well, I thought I...
Yeah, I thought that's what you said.
Running,
as long as you're not running, you're fine.
Engine running in gear is what Lewis
yeah.
said.
Oh, I appreciate it. That's what we wanted to do tonight. is get those comments, all the things that we need to consider. And I'm sure there'll be more as we go further along. Anything else, Captain? I believe that was the last. Any old business? New business? Yeah, me too. Yes, sir?
I'd like to make a comment. The comment was made earlier about the cactus thing where you wanted input from people, okay? The way to get that is to hold your meetings when they're available. When you're holding meetings at
9 o'clock in the morning, you're not going to get that fisherman in here. So I would suggest to you that if you make a recommendation to the commission that they hold some of their meetings in the evening, especially when the issue and the agenda item concerns recreational fishermen. Maybe once every 3 months hold an evening meeting so that we can come in and make our feelings known. I wish you would do that. I know you guys meet at night, but let's get the other commission to do the same thing. And if you could make a recommendation to them, I'd appreciate it.
We can suggest it.
Jeff, I can assure you that if recreational organizations worked at it, because when CCA years ago, when it was real big in the local area, it's now mostly up in D.C., we could fill this commission room full of recreational fishermen, and we did it several times.
You can still do it when you have the copia.
We filled the room in the afternoons.
Instead of 9 o'clock in the morning during the week.
Okay. All right.
Please. Say one last thing.
Sure.
Everyone was very nice about the February Black Sea Bass fishery, consensus, everything there. But when you leave, please help us out. We noticed a couple of things. One, last year when we had the permits, we had it on the individual, and then we realized, well, wait a minute, you know, the head boats, those individuals, they're not making such stuff. So we're changing that part of the regulation. We're trying to figure out, Pat and I, how to get an 800 number, because last year it was call operations before you come back in. That's not going to work. We need to get an 800 number that the private folks can call and say, you know, we're leaving from wherever else, please, those are leaving from, and we know that they'll be back. And that gives us the ability to get those samples as well. So we struggled a bit last year, but we do need to discuss friendly that we are the poster person. Absolutely. Our fishery is it. North Carolina is going to go again. They didn't have anything last year that was reported to Emmerich. Maybe they'll have something this year. But I asked the Mid-Atlantic Council of the ASMSC, I said, look, what do you want us to do? And you did this work last year. Is that good enough? And then there was a silence. And then finally someone said, well, yeah, just do what you did last year. So we need law enforcement, which we've talked a little bit, to have a presence. And we need to get the samples. And we need to cover all that. We missed a headboat last year. So, you know, that's why the, you know, what Alex showed you was over 6,000 pounds because we missed one of those headboats. But the VTR, special trip reports, they indicated that there was one other headboat. So this is something for the future. This is something that in 2013, I asked the Mid-Atlantic Council to have at least a 2015 fishery because it takes that long to get things through the federal chain. And by then, you know what happened. RSA problems happened, and everyone went another way on the February fishery, on the way to one fishery, January and February. So now we have a chance to do it again. What I think happens is if North Carolina is able to have a little bit of a fishery and we have a fishery, then the promise of NOAA is to start an LOA, a letter of authorization, where the state can apply directly to NOAA and have NOAA be responsible for, you know, a lot of this collection information or anything else. So good luck out there. Tell me how it is. I won't get up there. But wishing everybody luck.
All right. Motion to adjourn.
So made.
Seconded, I guess, as well, since two made it. We'd like to thank Pat Gear for finally explaining how that stoplight thing works. I've read the instructions on the website, and that was far worse, believe me. Oh, Lewis, can you, when you catalog this list of recommendations, send it to me. I'd like to send it out to the committee members on the towing. Okay, well... I'd like to...